screen on. And as the video people give me the high sign, therefore we're all ready. Good morning. I'll call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission for Thursday, April 24th to order for public comment. This is the time to address the commission on matters that are not on the agenda. And we have one speaker, Mr. Eric Greening. And while he's coming up, I'll talk about speaker slips. They're also available. And if you'd like to address the commission, if you'd be so kind as to fill one out so we'll get you in the right order and get your name spelled correctly. And take it away, Mr. Greening.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening. Happy Earth Year.
Queen Elizabeth's birthday to this month,
well,
too.
Yeah, God save the Queen. I'd like to thank your commission for sending letters to the Board of Supervisors relative to the ag cluster policies and to the inclusion of agricultural policies in the conservation element.
And my question for planning staff updates is, having sent the letter, is this now something that is automatically going to be agendized? Who actually has received the letter? What happens next, and is there a continuing need for citizen or other involvement in making sure something actually gets on an agenda so that the Board of Supervisors can act? Or is something getting on an agenda, and do we know the dates? So I just want to get those questions out there and hope they're dealt with during planning staff updates. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else to address the commission during public comments? Seeing no one else, I'll close it and start answering Eric's questions as to who gets the letter. I see it's addressed to the chairman and CC'd to the other four supervisors. But the only letter that I signed is the one recommendation to include ag element policies and conservation open space element update. I didn't sign one related to the ag cluster policies, and I was kind of asked the secretary where they was, and she said she didn't get one. And Chuck, ball's in your court.
Thank you. We will get that letter to you for your signature, and we apologize for that. As to the including the ag element in the conservation element, that letter, as you noted, went to Supervisor Patterson as chairman. We will be meeting with him and discuss possibility of agendizing that. Whether it's necessary to do that or not, we'll be discussing that with him.
This
commission's experience in the past with sending letters to the board requesting them to have a discussion about something seems to lead me to believe that it's essentially up to the chair who sets the agenda in terms of what gets on it. And so if members of the public feel that there's value in having a public discussion about the Planning Commission's recommendation, my suggestion to the public would be to contact the chair of the board and make your preferences known there.
Anything else for planning staff updates?
No, we don't.
I actually have a question, and I see Ms. Nieders in the room. I was wondering if it would be possible either today or at our next meeting to get an update of where we are in terms of the Santa Margarita Ranch response to comments on the EIR. I'm just interested in maybe hearing from staff, you know, what comments we got, how many, the issues that were raised, just so we can sort of keep abreast of how that's proceeding.
We could bring that during staff update next week.
I see Ms. Nieder getting up to the podium. So did you want to add something to that, Ms. Nieder, or are you going to be here at the next?
Ms. Miller now.
Oh, excuse me, Martha.
It's cool, Martha.
Are you going to be here next time, or?
Sure, I can bring an update next time, but just real briefly, we are working on the response to comments and the final EIR. The comments are posted on our website, so if people are interested in seeing what the volume of comments and what comments were raised, those are available. And we're right now tentatively scheduled for July 7th to start the Planning Commission hearings.
Great. Thank you.
And that's why I don't, it's not a final, so what you have evidently is the draft.
Right.
Okay. I don't want it until we get final.
But I just want to make sure that didn't preclude the presentation for our next meeting, correct? Great. Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to our next item, consent agenda, which consists of the January 10th Planning Commission minutes, a general plan conformity report, and several, the one thing that we're asking, this B is just some boilerplate
stuff. I was seeing the other ones as being under one. It's just my misread of the agenda. I just wanted clarification.
Seeing no commissioners having questions, I have one speaker, Mr. Eric Greening.
Thank you. Eric Greening, and I'm on
letter C, which is a time extension in San Miguel. This project got extensive discussion both here and at the Board of Supervisors relative to significant damage to cultural resources. The members of the Salinan tribe who actually physically did most of the building on the mission lived in what was known as neophyte quarters, and those were extensively damaged prior to this application being heard. And there was considerable mitigation called for in relation to various sort of non-ground-disturbing means of finding what can be salvaged of the archaeological information on the site. And my question is, what of that work has actually been done at this point, given that the project is apparently still active in that it's asking for a time extension? I have not seen any information released about findings or anything like that. I'm not sure what or when it would be, but has any work actually been begun with some of those high-tech means of investigating the archaeological resources on the site? And are the applicants in communication with tribal members and the people at the mission, all of whom have a real stake in the information that is derived therefrom? Thank you.
Okay. I certainly don't know the answer to that question. Anybody out there? I'm not seeing any staff members leap to the podium, so it's up to you, Chuck. Dance.
Chuck Stevenson, I am not aware of the technological work that's being done relative to the project, so I couldn't answer that. And I don't see anybody in the audience on this project here. So
perhaps somebody can come back next.
We'd be glad to report at your next meeting on that during the staff comment.
There's a member of the audience, I believe he's the applicant. Can you shed some light on this matter, sir? Give us your name for the record.
Good morning. Gordon Marshall. I'm the project manager for Mission Garden Estates. During the EIR process, we did extensive archaeological studies. We processed 21,000 pieces of bone. Not a single fleck of it is human. The economy has really hurt our project, and the extensive mitigations that were called for on this project to move forward haven't started yet.
Haven't started yet. Okay. Got it. Thank you. Here's your answer, Eric. Okay. Coming back to the commission. Discussion, action.
I move approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay. Motion second to approve consent agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. It's unanimous. All right, our first hearing item. Could we introduce that, Madam Secretary?
Mm-hmm.
continued hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend the land use ordinance and coastal land use ordinance by adding an inclusionary housing ordinance. County file number LRP 2006-00003, all supervisorial districts, Ted Bench, project manager.
Thank you, and good morning to the commission. I'm Ted Bench with County Planning. I'd like to get the PowerPoint up on the overhead screen. We have a PowerPoint presentation. If you remember, we did have this item scheduled on February 14th, I think it was, but the commission didn't have time on that day to have a full discussion of this item, so the PowerPoint's a little bit long this morning because we're actually doing two presentations in one. Maybe that's economy of time, but...
Oh, how you look at it.
Okay. A little background again. The reason that we're staff is dealing with, in fact, small units below 900 square feet are exempt from the in-lieu fee schedule. There are some incentives in the ordinance that, such as the if an applicant chooses to build all his affordable units on site, he only has a 15% affordability requirement instead of a 20% affordability requirement. Subdivisions need to pay their in-lieu fees up front, and that's because in previous commission hearings it was determined that it's a very difficult to track, say, affordable housing requirements after the date a map records. It's much simpler just to charge the fees up, in-lieu fees up front. Planning Commission's direction to staff in these from the previous hearings were, first of all, for that final EIR, bring the final EIR to the commission for full review and consideration. Also, to provide more information today on topics such as the housing market areas, affordable housing, should affordable housing that's built off-site be only built within city limits, and the in-lieu fees for subdivisions. How do you figure out what the in-lieu fee is if you don't want to, if you do recording the map, but you don't know what the size of the houses are going to be on their newly created lots? Staff's going to also talk about commercial linkage fees today. So let's start with the final environmental impact report. Now, let Jeff take it from there.
Good morning, Commission. Jeff Oliveira, Planning Department staff. For my part today, I'll just introduce a few brief slides on the Affordable Housing Ordinance Package, EIR. If you recall, the original draft EIR was circulated back in March of 2007. The final EIR was circulated after that in June. If you recall, new information was brought forward as a result of the circulation of the draft EIR and through subsequent Planning Commission hearings. In particular, new water availability and demand info was brought to light, and also an analysis of likely water resources, in particular for areas that are likely to experience the most growth as a result of the proposed project. Next slide. As a result of revised draft EIR was published and circulated back in January. In particular, that revised EIR included an update of the water resources section and included a change in the impact severity level for water resources from a Class 2 to a Class 1. Next slide. Subsequently, the revised final EIR was published, and that was circulated last Friday. Copies were sent to the commission. If anybody needs copies or on CD or hard copy, they're available at the Planning Department. The revised final included, as you'll see, response to comments as they relate to water resources. It included some minor edits to the text of the draft and the addition of the Title 27 in the project description. And that's where we are today. It was a brief summary. If you have any questions on the EIR in particular, I'm here to answer them. And also our EIR consultant, Richard Dalton from Rincon Consultants, is here as well. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Thanks. Is now the time, or you got more?
We'll keep going.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. So, jumping right into the discussion of housing market areas. The reason we're talking about housing market areas is that developers have a choice in the proposed ordinance to either build their units on site or pay in lieu fees or build units, affordable units, off site. And it's important that when a project has an affordable housing requirement, that the benefits, the affordable housing benefits, be kept either on site or in the same vicinity. So in light of one of the ways that we can outline where those vicinities are is, of course, using maps. And in the staff report, you see the map that's up on the screen now. It's the map that is used by the Park and Rec Department when they collect park and recreation fees, or Quimby fees. Those from new projects, those fees have to be spent in the same general vicinity as the project that paid the fees. So the Quimby map that's on the screen has five areas. One of the things about using this as an affordable house for affordable housing requirements is that you'll see Area 5 is a very large eastern side of the county, and the only urban area in Area 5 is Shandon. So say if you had a large project that was built somewhere in the east part of the counties, I think I've heard of Eagle's Nest near Creston. The only place, if they wanted to put affordable units off-site, the only place they could do it would be in Creston or Shandon. Had to build more affordable units. They could build those units anywhere. They could along the 101 corridor, say Napoma, or they could build them in Oceano. So that's the purpose of the map on the screen. It includes Oceano in the southern part of the map. Another thing that the staff did a little research on for the commission is this issue of whether off-site units should all be located in urban areas, particularly inside city limits. What staff did, of course, is contact its counterpart in the city's planning department, and city staff raised some warnings. Although they see the benefits, that it's good to have urban or affordable housing units be built within areas where the urban services and the structures are already in place. And it helps the cities to meet their affordable housing requirements. You have the other issues, which are that it can create some uncertainty in the process for the developer. He doesn't know if when he proposes units inside a city limit, what kind of response he'll have to his affordable units being built in the city. It requires a separate city permit review process as well. Cities can't guarantee timely approval of units that would be built inside the city. So based on all of that, staff suggests that we actually use the housing market area concept that, just as that map showed on the screen a couple of slides back, that if a project wants to build its affordable units off-site, that it could build it anywhere in the housing market area, including inside a city limit. But it should not be, affordable units should not be restricted to only being placed inside city limits. We talked in the past about residential subdivisions as well. And again, the when in lieu fees would be collected for new subdivisions. The Planning Commission determined that these fees should be collected at the time that the final map is recorded. But again, that makes the question of, well, what should the fee be, since at the you'll know how many lots you have, and you'll even know the size of the lots, but you won't know what the size of the house will be when the lot is sold. So the commission directed staff to take a look at what the average size of a house is in each zone, and what you see on the screen is the response. In a residential single-family zone, the average house that permits have been issued for is about 2,200 square feet. And in an agricultural zone with lots over 20 acres in size, the house average house size is about 2,600 square feet. The fees that we would collect under the proposed fee schedule that you can find in the economic feasibility report would be roughly the following amount. For that single family zone lot and house that's an average size of 2,200 square feet, the fee would be about $21,000. For the agriculture zone with a house at 2,600 square feet, the fee would be about $25,000. And that, again, is a fee that would be collected at the time the final map is recorded for residential subdivisions.
And that's per parcel?
Go ahead.
Parcel?
Now I want to talk a little bit about linkage fees. The staff has had several contacts with commercial developers and the public at large about linkage fees, the fees that would be required of new commercial development to pay their share of the affordable housing needs that are created when new commercial buildings are built. And essentially, we had a large meeting on February 28th with about 14 or 15 commercial developers and their agents. And I'll share some of the results of that meeting in a minute. But I want to start by saying that the staff had a nexus study prepared that says that, on the average, the new commercial development in this county, what's on the screen right now is the chart that comes out of the nexus study that shows the dollar amount per square foot that the study found could be charged to new commercial development. Again, if commercial development was going to pay the full cost of the housing impact that it has on the county, then it would be charged the maximum fee that you see in that chart. The study had recommended that only 10% of that full fee be charged. But again, based on the economic situation that we're facing right now, staff suggests that a 5% fee be charged for new commercial development. I want to skip to this slide right here, because this one shows the four-year phase that staff is recommending for that linkage fee. For retail development, the full linkage fee would be $2.11, and that would be what new commercial development would pay at the end of a four-year period. But when you phase it in, you'll have the numbers that you see on the chart on the screen, which is year one, you'd have 25% of that fee, year two, 50%, and so on until you get up on the fourth year to paying the full 5% linkage fee. This is what staff is recommending. Oops. again, when we talked to the commercial developers, they raised some key issues, which is that they feel that the ordinance needs to provide them some incentives and flexibility in how they meet the affordable housing requirement. They would like to see a countywide solution, not just the requirements being placed on developers to meet the affordable housing needs. And they have questions about the Nexus study. Staff responded to all those issues in the staff report. And today I'm just going to touch on possible incentives or options that could be in place in the ordinance to make to bring the flexibility that hopefully would help the developers meet the affordable housing requirement. To start with, the draft ordinance that's attached to the staff report already allows exemptions for smaller commercial projects that are under 5,000 square feet. Developers can either choose to pay the linkage fee or build housing units on site. Some other options that could be considered or added to the ordinance, if your commission directs staff to do so, would be exempting mixed-use projects, the commercial portion of a mixed-use project. And a mixed-use project is one where at least 25% of the floor space is for commercial use. Some alternative methods of meeting affordable housing requirements could be in placed into the ordinance, such as accepting of affordable housing units on-site or off-site, or accepting land donations, or giving credit for employee housing programs. The affordable housing requirements could be lowered if the developer chooses to build the units on-site. Say if a developer, commercial developer, will provide the units on-site, then we could lower the affordability requirement so that it's 80% of what he would have been required to provide rather than 100%. We can collect the linkage fees at the time a building is final rather than upfront when the permit is issued. These are all provisions that, if the commission so desires, staff can add those into the draft ordinance. Last of all, I'm trying to wrap this up. Staff has found that when we collect all these fees, we of course need to create a fund to put the fees in. And it's much more legally defensible and easier for the public to understand if that fund is dealt with in a standalone ordinance or code rather than being made a part of the inclusionary housing ordinance. And for that reason, staff has created a new Title 27, which is attached to the staff report, and staff recommends be a part of the inclusionary housing ordinance and program, if you will. Some of the key points in that new Title 27 that's attached to the staff report, and I'll go through the chapters really quickly. Chapter 1, of course, is the purpose statement for the new Affordable Housing Fund, May 22nd, and that would give the commission more time to review the final EIR and also time for staff to insert any additional changes into the ordinance at the commission's request. And that concludes staff presentation.
Before we go, I'd like us to decide what our plan for today is. As you were going through those, there looked like there were a dozen bullets there that we need to discuss and talk about and reach a consensus on and give you direction and go on. We've also got the adequacy of the EIR. We've got the new Title 27, and as well as you posed about four questions in the staff report that we need to come to an agreement on. So I see that's a pretty big thing to bite off all at once. Does anybody have any suggestions where they'd like to go here? And also, so we could get the public's input on perhaps many of those issues, and it'd be tough to squeeze all that into 3 minutes.
I'd like to go the 2 hours we've allotted, and then if we're not finished, just go to the meeting on the 22nd.
Okay, I would assume that, but what particular bites are we going to take today?
Well, I think we've still got a lot of, I agree with you, we've got some fundamental policy questions that we need to have a conversation about before we, you know, can agree on specific language changes that are being proposed to the actual ordinance. I didn't think that we were going to get through the whole thing today. I mean, I would like to spend some more time with the EIR personally.
Your time from 11 to 12 last night wasn't good enough?
No, I wasn't at my best. So, you know, I'm thinking we hear public comment, and as we discuss these policy issues, if members of the public want to weigh in, I wouldn't mind hearing from them. Again, we don't have a full room, obviously. I don't think that's going to be a burden on the commission, but I'd really like to have a discussion about some of the recommendations that are being made and some of the assumptions that are being made.
Ready?
Well, I would, one, agree that we attempt to, you know, not go past the two-hour time limit that we put forward today. I think we can probably continue to agree to disagree on some of the policy statements, and at some point we just have to recognize that a majority of the commission feels that this is appropriate or not appropriate. I think we just kind of delve into this and start. I mean, I'm sure I, along with other commissioners, do have some questions on some of the new information that was presented.
Okay, so the first...
That didn't help you very much, did it,
no,
Bob?
No, it didn't, but okay, so I'm going to...
Do you have an idea, Bob?
Well, the staff has, I think, about four items we need to decide upon. That's in the staff report, never mind all the bullets they gave us today, one of which, do we agree with their decision not to engage the cities as part of this inclusionary housing fund, and they recommended not to because the city's responses weren't very positive. And then the in-lieu fees for residential subdivision, they proposed, you know, residential single family, we would just assume that's a 2,200 square foot house, and that's on page 1-6 of the staff report. You know, there.
So maybe what I'm hearing you say is let's go through the staff report and talk about that before we get to the ordinance. Is that what you're inclined to do?
Yeah, and the next one was the, 20%, 10%, 5%, commercial linkage fees, that sort of thing.
When will you do public comment?
I'll kind of give the public a warning of where we want to go. That leaves the whole new Title 27. I got a whole bunch of questions on that. And that leaves a bunch of questions on the EIR, the new, especially, you know, the water issues, shall we say. But I'll put those off and make these decisions first. And there's probably some bullets that you had on your PowerPoint that
today would affordable housing in the cities, limiting it to the cities, the map and the subdivision fees. If you're happy with that, then that staff will move forward on those items. Thank you.
We'll do that. And that's going to give the public some direction. By the time we get back to the EIR in 27, we'll open up the public again. So if they wanted to weigh in, then I know Mr. Wynn is probably going to have an opinion on the draft EIR, but I'm kind of telling you to save that. Use your 3 minutes for these other arguments. With that, I only have one speaker left.
Can we ask some questions of staff on the report
that
was just given?
Yeah.
On 1-3, it talks about a sliding scale for homeowner association fees. Could I have an explanation? I didn't quite understand the explanation that was in the staff report. It didn't sort of rationalize to me. So would you mind just kind of going through how we feel these are workable?
Dana Lilly, with your planning staff, I'll give an attempt at that. We found out two things. I'll start with one that we know the most about because it's our ordinance. The county's long-term affordability price limits that were recently revised a little over a year ago changed the sales price based on the actual costs, including the homeowners association fees. So if there is the ability of a developer to provide variable homeowners fees, perhaps based on unit size or something like that, then they're going to be strongly motivated to do that so that they can sell the affordable units at a higher price because the people can be
right.
will be able to afford it. The other piece that we found is we have very little ability as a governmental agency to mandate that homeowners fees be certain adjusted by affordability. And getting back to the first point, we probably don't have to, since there's a strong financial incentive for the developer to accomplish that if it's possible.
Can I follow up on that question?
Sure.
The way I understand a homeowners association, it's elected residents of the development. So the developer comes in, you know, he gets the subdivision, he builds the structures, he sells the units, and he's out of there. And it's the homeowners association that is elected among the residents that carries on from there, and they set the fees, not the developer. So the developer could, you know, agree, you know, could set fees on, you know, day one of the project, but on day two, he's in, you know, you know, he's moved on. And the homeowners association can do whatever they want with rates. So.
Well, we do know that the developer has to work with the Department of Real Estate to get those initial fees set. And sure, later, once the developer's out of it, it's up to the homeowners association. And if county council is available to comment on the legal ability of the county to insist that there be a fee structure that varies by affordability or unit size.
Yeah, that's what we'd like to hear, I think.
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. We certainly haven't ever tried to do anything like that up till now. We have very little involvement in the operation of the homeowners associations that exist. Although, as you know from working on the Planning Commission, when we approve subdivisions that have conditions of approval that require the installation of things like drainage basins and recreational features. We also require in those projects that the CCNRs for the project require the homeowners association to maintain those things. And we also have a provision in those CCNRs that allows the county, in the event that things aren't being maintained, to step in and require that to happen. So I suppose it might be possible to construct a requirement on a development approval that would go a little bit further and require that the CCNRs not only maintain particular things but also fund them adequately so that they don't degrade and whatnot. And I guess if you can get to that point, then maybe you can get to the point of telling people how to divide up the funding of those things. But obviously we haven't looked into that, and that would that would take us sort of one step further than where we are now. I think now we could require that
like progress.
Things be maintained, but I don't know that we really could.
It's a good idea. Personally, I think we should do it. And if something comes up, you know, if there's a new law that gets passed, or, you know, there's some, you know, somebody sues us, or, you know, but in the absence of any compelling legal reason not to do it, I suggest we give it a try.
and perhaps staff didn't make as convincing a description of how our ordinance works. If the county did mandate that the affordable units have a lower homeowners association fee than the market rate units, that would allow the developer to sell the affordable units higher, and it would make no difference to the purchasing household because their payments on their mortgage would be higher to compensate. That's how our long-term affordability ordinance works. So if all the homeowners association fees are the same in a development, those affordable units are affordable to the targeted income groups because we're counting all of their monthly costs.
Well, then I think we should fix that because the developer is not affected by the rate of the homeowner's fee. And so if he sets a low fee so that he can sell the units higher and then he's out of the game and 2 years down the road the homeowners association goes, holy cow, we can't even, you know, keep our gutters clean for this low fee, and they jack it up, the poor person who's in there, you know, the because they met the affordability requirements, is now faced with the fact that they A, paid a higher price for their unit, and B, now have homeowners fees that are you know, perhaps going beyond their ability to meet. So let that sounds like something else we need to fix.
But I don't think we can do that. What I got out of this, Commissioner Rapa, was about this homeowners, so there ain't a darn thing we can do about it. We can try, as Dana has already tried, to suggest that you need to structure them. And I would suggest, you know, the one-bedroom units would pay less than the three-bedroom units to an extent because they would probably have a smaller roof area. And if they were one-bedroom, they would probably have less need for parking than the three-bedroom unit. But then there are other things such as the overall drainage basin or the, you know, that you might not be able to make that nexus between the size of the unit. I don't think we can get too complicated with it because, as Commissioner Christie points out, 3 years later, the Homeowners Association could decide that, you know, all these affordable units have just as much load on the maintenance needs as everyone else. So they're going to have to pay what everyone else does.
Well,
we couldn't do a thing about it.
Well, one thing we do know, I think, from our experience is that the county hasn't ever really become involved in trying to enforce these provisions of CCNRs that we do currently attempt to mandate. And, you know, I'm thinking it's probably because someone decided that the value that we would obtain for the time and money that we would invest in doing that just wasn't worth it. Because I'm also guessing that there's probably subdivisions that aren't maintaining the things that we're requiring them to maintain and so forth. So you might be opening up a pretty big administrative job on the part of the county, too, if you were to get the county involved in trying to determine whether or not a fair rate was being charged to these affordable units in there.
But if there was a deed restriction at the time of approval that said that the residents of the affordable units shall pay 25% less than the residents of the market rate units, I wouldn't expect that the county would be monitoring that and putting a great deal of enforcement effort into seeing that that gets done. But at least everyone involved in that complex would understand that that's the rule, that's the requirement. And any resident, if that got ignored, the resident themselves would have a course of action that they could personally take.
True. I think Commissioner Christie's absolutely right. And that was the reason partially that I asked the question, is I fully understand about the initial sale and then with the subsequent homeowners association governed by the homeowners, property owners, etc. But if we can at least consider in our conditions of approval some type of wording that does acknowledge that the affordable units will have a reduced, I don't know the wording, and I'm not even totally sure that it's equitable, but I do think that if we're kidding ourselves, if we just accept the initial Well, it's going to be less because the sales prices. I mean, that to me doesn't address the problem versus what at least the staff report indicated was an initial solution.
You know, the concern is, Bob, if we don't do something like that, then those people won't even be in the homeowners association meetings 5 years from now because they won't be able to afford their monthly upkeep.
Okay.
I do have a couple of other questions. On the housing market areas, and I totally agree. The map looks really good. I just have a question. Fees, in lieu fees that are collected, say in Area 1, will those fees be restricted to be utilized in Area 1, or will they be available in any area?
The way the draft ordinance can be set up is so that the fees would only be used in the same area.
Okay. The other, I have a couple of other questions on, there was a discussion about, obviously, about city limits and things like that and encouraging development in urbanized areas. Maybe I missed them, but I didn't see any incentives for someone who could actually take and locate their either land, affordable units, in lieu fees, whatever, within the city limits of any of our municipalities. In other words, if I were a developer and I was, you know, required to pay in lieu fees or whatever in Napomo, but I said, you know what, I know that the city of Arroyo Grande could really use these fees, or I could donate this piece of property. I didn't see in here an incentive to encourage the person whose project is in Napomo to do that. And if we're really focused on trying to concentrate development in areas where we know the infrastructure exists, was that a discussion area that staff had? And do you have any suggestions?
Staff does have one suggestion. If it's the commission's desire that there be some incentive for the affordable units to be built in cities, you could direct staff to structure the ordinance so that the incentive is similar to the one that's now in the ordinance for on-site, which is if we had it's a reduced affordability requirement. If we had a 20% requirement on the face of the ordinance, but you're going to build the units in your project, and it's only 15% requirement, perhaps we should add or in the cities, that if your commission liked that. That would be one incentive.
Well, I just open that up to other commissioners to think about, because if we're trying to kind of use the carrot versus the stick approach, that makes sense to me.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Too. Sounds unanimous to me. Next item.
Now I have to remember my questions here. It would again be the same thing with linkage fees. If we could offer incentives or something to include those within the city limits. I mean, they're kind of follow. Obviously, I'm kind of thinking along a particular line. Because I do understand the limitations, although I have to admit, I really wish that we could at least encourage the board to continue a dialogue with the cities that started many, many years ago and somehow dropped off the face of the earth about, you know, trying to cooperate on where growth is appropriate or isn't or might be most effective.
Commissioner Rapper, I have a question along those lines. When you're talking about incentives, I agree with you. But I wonder if we could agree that the least best incentive is reducing the number of units or parcels or that need to be provided. Because I've seen we've done that in other areas. If you build them on site, you need to build, you know, you build fewer. And I'm wondering if we can provide incentives like you know, reduced fees or, you know, increase the speed, you know, the priority processing or other types of incentives that don't end up at the end of the day reducing the number of units that get built. Do we agree on that?
I don't know if we agree. I'm certainly open to think about it. I don't know. I guess that wasn't one of my thought processes I was going through. That's all I have for now.
Okay.
Anyone else before we go to the public?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions as well. Let me go back to where they began. On the next page, on the top of 112, we're exempting residential development that complies with the state density bonus law. Can you just briefly tell us what the state's density bonus law is and how that compares with the density bonus in this ordinance?
I better try. The home builders felt quite strongly about this. They recommended that the county allow them to choose whether they comply with our inclusionary requirement or instead they choose to comply with the state's density bonus ordinance law. It's a sliding scale of a density bonus from 20% up to a maximum of 35%, but you only get the bonus if you're building units on site. So that's one difference.
Do they have to be deed restricted for affordable?
Yeah, they would in our case because the county wouldn't recognize them as affordable unless they weren't deed restricted.
Okay.
So they could provide, I think, 10% low income, and they would get their 20% density bonus. The bottom line here is really, even if the county didn't have this provision, we think that state density bonus law would still give them that bonus with that small amount of affordable housing. You could consider it an incentive to build units in your project because they may be able to build a fewer number of units in the project under state density bonus law in some circumstances.
A fewer number of affordable units.
Correct.
If I might.
Fewer even than our reduced percentage under the proposed ordinance? Because we give an incentive if you build it on site, you don't have to do 20%, you can do 15%, correct?
There was a previous staff report where we had a chart that laid out the number of units that would be required either in the county ordinance or the state density bonus law, and it was based on the size of the project, 5 units, 10 units, 15 to 20 units, and it was very similar.
Okay.
Whether you chose to do the state density bonus law or the county ordinance, in most cases, you ended up having to do the same number of affordable units. But the county ordinance is more flexible because it allows you to either pay in lieu fees or build units off-site.
Right. I just wanted to make sure we weren't undermining ourselves by deferring to the state density bonus law, that we weren't creating a situation where everybody would do that because it was an easier requirement to comply with.
Based on what we're hearing from the home builders, we think that's unlikely. I mean, the bottom line for them is they think it's going to be rare when a developer chooses to build the units on site. In most cases, they're going to want to give us land or give us in lieu fees or build them somewhere else. The only way they get a state density bonus is if they build them in the project. And state density bonus law also does not recognize the workforce housing category of affordable housing that the county does. Under our ordinance, the first affordable required unit is a workforce unit. So it's a mix.
There also are some other parts to the state density bonus law, such as some parking. There are some other advantages, in my opinion, to affordable housing that come by way of using the state density bonus law. But that's just my perspective.
If I could add to that, both the state and the county do the same thing. They allow the developer to ask for additional incentives, such as waiving parking requirements or setback requirements. the draft ordinance mirrors the state law in that respect.
Reducing parking, not waiving.
Yeah, right, right.
Thank you. Yeah, I was...
It gets extremely complicated, you guys.
We could probably do a whole study session state density bonus law.
On page 113 under D2, we're saying that we're talking about in terms of determining base density, we're saying that the average slope for the entire site may be used for the slope test instead of the average slope for each proposed parcel. What is the effect of that policy what does that mean in real life terms?
In real life terms, it means kind of two things. The first being it makes it easier to figure out how many units total are going to be in the project, including any bonus units, rather than fully designing a project with engineers and everything to figure out the large portions of the site for streets and other things. In a case where you have, actually, let me restate that. I apologize, I got that wrong, because we will be having to do a calculation of how much internal area will be for public purposes. We think it will be just a slight increase, yes, in that kind of case.
Okay.
Sorry, I had to remember.
In D3, it says the base density for a site in a land use category other than RSF or RMF is the maximum number of residential parcels that are allowable under this title, not including any density bonuses provided. So I'm assuming that applies to, say, land that's zoned for agriculture, for ag zoning. If you had a 300-acre parcel, your base density would be based on the minimum parcel size for
agriculture. That's correct.
Is that correct? So how would that be applicable, or how would that policy interface with our ag cluster ordinance, which already, you know, there's a density bonus factor in our ag cluster ordinance. The land is still zoned ag. How would we be able to apply this to ag clusters to get affordable units in ag clusters?
Well, with the ag, I'm going to say that with the ag cluster subdivision, that's set for, if you do the calculations for how many units lots you can have under the ag cluster ordinance, that gives you the maximum number of units you'll be able to have. This won't add to that. This won't give you more units.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is you've got, if you're looking at a piece of ag land that somebody, that the county is going to allow somebody to develop, you look at the base density of what it could be subdivided down to if it was just a straight subdivision. Say that number is 100. And then the calculations get done based on soils and irrigation, and say the ag cluster number comes up to be 125. That's how many units they get to build. When we apply our affordable housing ordinance to that, are we requiring a percentage of the 100 number or the 125 number?
Well, you would be applying the 100 number unless you are also applying for an ag cluster division. Then, if you do apply for an ag cluster division, you'd get the 125 units.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They are doing an ag cluster, and the number that they've come up with is 125. So we would be talking about 20% of 125, not 20% of 100, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. It's post-multiplier.
Yeah, this ordinance will not allow any more units to go on the property than what the zone would normally allow, except as an incentive, you can get a one-to-one density bonus for every affordable unit you build on site.
Even in an ag cluster?
I believe so.
Okay.
That is?
I'm sorry, I do have one more. I don't know if other people are having questions.
Go ahead.
In lieu fees for residential subdivisions, there's on page 1-6, there's a staff note that the rural lands and ag category over 10 acres is perhaps utilized by mobile homes. Am I reading that correctly?
Yep.
I'm sorry if I...
Oh, 1-6.
Yes.
It's at the bottom of the page, and it's talking about sort of, you know, why we have these smaller lots and larger houses and whatever. And it talks about the over 10 acres, and those would be, at least our experience, I think, has shown that those would be used by mobile homes, or those would be occupied, I should say, by mobile homes.
You're right. The
okay, I just want to make, that's what the staff report says?
What the staff report's saying is we found it surprising that the average house size in the large ag parcels was less, and it's because we're getting more farm support quarter permits out there, which are usually mobile homes, double
wide. Mobile home farm support quarters are exempt, though. If I'm going to put a mobile home on a piece of property that's 10 acres or more, my fee as I look at it is an additional almost $25,000. It's on 1-42. It's $24,700.
Oh, I misunderstood if you were saying what
additional almost $25,000 fee on top of that seems counterproductive.
But the way I understand the ordinance, this wouldn't apply if there was just a person with 10 acres that wanted to put a mobile home on it.
Sure.
It only happens when you're doing a subdivision, or you know, when you're developing multiple parcels. Single family residence, whether it's a mobile home or a McMansion.
Okay, then I probably didn't understand it.
Correct. Yeah. Okay, now we're ready for the public?
Yep.
Let's do it. First speaker, Michael Williams, followed by Ermina Karam. And again, you'll have more than one opportunity here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Wynn. I'm speaking from Napomo. And I'm only talking about the housing part, not CEQA at this time, if I understand you correctly. I only have one suggestion to make. When you talk about housing market areas, why not just stay with the 5 supervisorial district lines that we have now? The problem with changing it the way it's being proposed is that it would actually allow people in District 5, about 50% of District 5 could be transferring their inclusionary housing into Napomo. It's the only place that they would go there, or conceivably Oceano. And yet the Quimby fees would actually still be staying out in District 5 in that Quimby mapped area. I don't think that makes good sense. I think the mitigation fee should go where the impacts are taken, and which means I don't think we should transfer the impacts and keep the fees someplace else. Beyond that, I think on a political level, you recognize that you're still going to have to be dealing with the supervisor of the district in which this growth is taking place. You just keep one set of lines instead of having 3 different maps, one for Quimby's, one for houses, one for supervisors. I think it becomes unnecessarily complicated. So for that reason, I encourage you to consider the 5 supervisorial areas as your boundaries. Thank you.
Thank you. Ermina Karam, followed by John Knight.
My name is Ermina Karim. I'm here today representing the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber applauds the county's efforts to address our region's clear need for affordable housing. It's a critical community issue, and it deserves a community-wide answer. The proposed ordinance, however, puts the entire burden on new residential and commercial development, and it's for this reason that the Chamber opposes the proposed ordinance. We urge you to take additional time. As evidenced today, there are a lot of changes as we're going through the process. It's a complicated problem, and it requires a comprehensive solution. We'd like to be part of that solution-seeking team. And we'd urge you to take more time so that we can find an answer that encourages residential and commercial development. Thank you.
Ms. Karim?
Yes.
We've heard this criticism from other chambers as well, that this all of the burden is being put on new development. And it seems to me that the answer to that is to put some of the burden on existing development. And I don't know how we do that other than imposing new taxes or fees on, you know, existing businesses and residents. And I, as much as I think that would be a more equitable solution, I think we all realize that it would also be, you know, politically, if not legally, impossible. The city can't impose new taxes. That, you know, it'd have to go to a vote, and nobody's going to do that. And so by making that argument, essentially, I think what the chamber is doing unintentionally is suggesting that we follow a different course of action that would ultimately result in nobody having any responsibility for affordable housing. So unless you have some other, or the chamber has some other suggestions about how the load could be spread in a way that really is politically and legally feasible.
Well, I think you hit on something that's really critical, which is political will. One place that we can look at was what the County of Los Angeles did in passing a general obligation bond to fund this need. They put it out there, and it had overwhelming support. I think 76% voted in favor of that. I think that we, because this is, or the chamber feels, maybe this is a possible solution. We don't know. We've only been studying it for the last few months. We'd like to take more time for that reason to see if this is something that might be a potential solution. But putting it out so that the community understands that it's all of our burden.
Thank you. John Knight, and that's the last speaker I have.
Good morning, John Knight with RM Design Group. I represent a lot of developer, residential development clients as well as home builders, and I think I can fairly say that they wouldn't support an inclusionary housing ordinance. That said, I think the political, my biggest concern or issue, fees paid at the time that the map is recorded. It's a big burden to get a development project approved. It takes a long time. The environmental review process, EIRs now cost $700,000. With the fees and the time and the processing, planning fees, development fees, application fees. Developers are in for a tremendous amount of money by the time they finally get to the final map. It would really benefit the development community, the builders, if we could have those fees paid at the time of building permit. And that's consistent with a lot of your other fees. Most fees are collected at time of building permit. So I would encourage you to reconsider the payment of the fees at the time of final map. Building permit is when the impact occurs. Commercial exemption for 5,000 square feet, I think that's a good idea. Phasing in the program, that's an excellent idea. A lot of my clients have disappeared, and that's because the market is so difficult right now. And you can see they're not in the audience, and I think that's because they're just trying to survive. So I like the phase-in program. You might want to consider completely exempting mixed use. We all see the benefits from mixed use. You might consider exempting certain mixed use type projects completely from the fee. I think that would encourage, I like the idea of so an incentive to provide the units on site. I think larger developers and people who have built in Santa Barbara County or other counties to the south will consider building on site. I think there's greater value to having that on site. Consider incentives to provide smaller homes, smaller lots. I think there's a bit of that in there. And I really like the variety of options that are in the ordinance. Encourage you to keep those, especially the land dedication. I think that's a great idea. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, let's take our morning break. When we come back, staff can respond to public comment. Come back at 10:25. 10:25 it is. And is the video people ready?
Yep.
They're giving me the high sign. Okay, I will call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission back to order. We just closed public comment on inclusionary housing, and staff was going to respond to some of the points raised.
Yes, thank you. Ted Bench with Planning. The one idea that was proposed about using the supervisorial districts map as a map for the affordable housing ordinance, that has merit. The staff It's not committed to the four-part map that was shown on the screen earlier. And so the Planning Commission can give staff direction on that, and staff will carry it out.
Why did the Parks Department go out of that to use their Quimby map, which is what we considered first, and then we modified that a little, or you modified that a little bit?
My map section in the Planning Department took a look at that Quimby map and said it wasn't identical to the supervisor's district map. There's some differences in it, which I can't remember. They explained what the differences are. I can't give a better explanation than that.
Well, is this on? I mean, the supervisorial districts are gerrymandered.
Really?
I don't know how else to say this, but if you look
not
at...
Not that your house was ever marked around.
Oh, one. No, never. That didn't ever happen. I mean, if you look especially at the Quimby map, Area 3, which includes the city of San Luis Obispo, and you look at the proposed housing market areas map, which is, again, a duplication. If you look at the supervisorial district map, the city of San Luis Obispo has four different supervisors. There are four areas. You have District 2, which comes down into the...
Everybody but one.
Everybody but Harry. Right. So I guess I would be very skeptical of using the district map, personally.
As would I.
The Quimby fee map is the same or different the supervisorial map?
It's a little different.
It's different, yeah.
But not so you'd hardly notice.
Well, look at the city of San Luis.
Yeah.
You'll see the Quimby map stays north of the grade. I think that was their theory, being on the Parks Commission at the time.
Well,
obviously, the recreational needs of the north and south grade people differ.
My concern, even with the...
Searching a number of potential, essentially new taxes that could be voted on by the population, the bottom line is, in some of them, you can dedicate for a specific purpose, like affordable housing, but you would require it would require a two-thirds vote of the populace, and there's at least one funding possible new tax that even with a two-thirds vote, you couldn't dedicate it. Now, we're still doing some research, and we're going to present some information at some point to the Board of Supervisors and see if they want to direct us to work further on those community-wide solution categories, but they're not available now.
But this L.A. did 76%? How could 76% of the people agree on anything?
With a general obligation bond, you can pass it with a simple majority, but then it's just goes into the general fund and it's budgeted every year. With a two-thirds majority, then you could dedicate it. So they must have.
Well, and I don't know if Mr. Lilly or Mr. McNulty wants to respond, but I think it would be important to note that passage of a general obligation bond, that's not free money. I mean, we still have to pay that money back, and that, you know, with interest. And that comes out of the general fund? I mean, if we were to get the vote to pass a general obligation bond in San Luis Obispo County, where would the repayment money come from?
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. My understanding is that you would identify a potential source of such repayment, and then on top of that, you would identify collateral that would be available in the event that the source couldn't pay off. So you would both identify some sort of a funding stream that you would dedicate to that purpose. You would then perhaps obligate the general fund, and then above and beyond that, even you would pick pieces of real estate, for example, that would serve as collateral in the event that the bonds couldn't be repaid.
Well, we seem to be going way above our pay grade here, because we're not going to do that, but why does it have to be a bond? Why can't, if this general obligation, well, not, if there was this tax for this specific purpose, why couldn't you collect some monies every year and then spend those monies every year or every 2 years as the opportunities arose.
Well, I think the problem there would be the one that we have with the road improvement fees now, and that is you can never collect enough money to keep up with the inflationary effect of, on construction costs. So the idea would be that you borrow money, you perform a project now at a fixed cost that you understand, and then you pay it back over time, or your kids do, as they pay their taxes.
But can I ask a kind of a follow-up question? On a general obligation bond, there's interest charged on, and so that would actually help to reduce the amount of monies that are available for affordable housing. Is my train of thought going the right direction?
Yeah, you do need to pay interest back on those as well.
Right. Obviously. I mean, we would sell these bonds to somebody, and they would be sold to them, and we would pay interest on that.
The other thing to keep in mind with bonding is that there's a limit to how much you can borrow, and at some point, the closer you get to that limit, the higher you have to pay for the money that you borrow. So that's another thing that the county's quite concerned about when it comes to selling bonds.
And with the talk of the tough economic times, I mean, the county itself is in tough economic times. I can't imagine that it would be prudent to take on, you know, an additional obligation like that. I don't think anybody thinks inclusionary housing is the whole, complete, total answer and solution to San Luis Obispo's affordable housing problem, but it's a piece of it. And while I think it's important for us to continue to move forward talking about other pieces of it, I don't think the inclusionary housing policies should be delayed until those other conversations have been concluded.
Did staff have other comments on comments?
Fees at the...
What about a parcel tax that was mentioned?
Since you ask, we could do a parcel tax. We could also do a transfer tax. A parcel tax would require a vote of the 2/3 of the people. A transfer tax you could do with a simple majority, but then Prop 13 has changed the Constitution, so you couldn't dedicate a transfer tax. And there are some other sources of tax-based revenues we've been looking at, and that could be another study session if you'd like at some point.
But it sounds like that was for the board, not for us. Okay, what about fees at the map recordation versus building permit time?
At in earlier hearings, we had a good discussion on that, and the disadvantage of delaying or deferring the fee to the time the house is built is that it's
different. Are pulled. I'm not yet clear that we can move it either further forward from that point to, say, for example, the point where the map is recorded. So before we can assure ourselves that we can do that, we're going to need to do a little more work.
Could you, you're just saying that the staff recommendation has not had legal review?
Well, this particular part of it is
that's
come up before. If the fee that we're imposing is being imposed under the Government Code Section 66,000 and those sections that follow that section, there's a specific limitation there that requires that you collect a fee at the time of occupancy, and if you satisfy other requirements in that section, you can move the fee forward to the time where building permits are pulled. But I'm not aware yet of the authority that allows you to move it from the time building permits are pulled forward to the point at which the map is actually recorded.
Oh, we have a little more work to do on that one then, I guess. Huh?
Yeah.
So, just to continue on that, we also have the process by which you... some developer just develops this 10-lot subdivision and doesn't have a conditional use permit to build anything on it. He intends to sell those lots one at a time or to whomever, undetermined yet. And so we come up with this idea, well, we're going to use the average building size for residential single family, therefore the fee will be this. Sounds like that idea might be in legal jeopardy also.
Well, I think the issue is whether or not the fee is being imposed as in a development impact fee or some other fee, and if it's not specifically under 66,000, then you may not be limited in the way that statute section spells out those limitations. So
We need to kind of resolve this issue among staff so we have some clear direction.
What do other jurisdictions do? I mean, I can't believe we're the only jurisdictions to ever talk about.
Well, for example, I know that the fee that we're talking about here today, that's the linkage fee, is proposed to be imposed pursuant to the development impact fee statute. So clearly that one would be limited. A fee that you would pay in lieu of units that you would provide, I don't know that it necessarily is limited to AB 1600. I don't know that that's the only authority to impose a fee like that.
But don't other jurisdictions charge fees, affordable housing fee, you know, in lieu fees for subdivisions of land?
Sure, they do. Like I said, I'm not sure whether they are characterizing those as AB 1600 fees or something else.
So we just need to maybe do a survey of those jurisdictions.
Well, I just need to do some work on it.
Okay.
We'll give you something to do there. Okay. We also had one, the completely exempt mixed use. Want to comment on that?
Staff recommendation on that is that mixed use should have privileges, but only so far as the requiring the affordable housing fees and on the residential portion of the mixed-use project. The commercial part can be exempt, and then you have the definition of what is a mixed-use project, because somebody might want to make it so that it's all commercial and put in a caretaker unit and say, okay, now it's a mixed-use project, so it's exempt from the affordable housing ordinance. And we're saying we would support exempting a project, a mixed-use project, where at least 25% of the project is a commercial project, and we'd be in support of exempting the commercial portion of the project. So 75% of the project could be residential. Staff would suggest that the commercial part, the 25%, be exempt from the ordinance, but that the residential portion still would, the ordinance would apply.
How does that encourage mixed use when 75% would still come under the ordinance?
One of the things we're concerned about is that when you look at the mixed use projects that are being proposed in downtown San Luis Obispo, those are high-end units, residential units. Now, can't necessarily apply that to the countywide. If you get a mixed-use project in San Miguel, certainly the residential components or units would be more affordable. But again, the benefits of the ordinance would still apply. The smaller the, in a mixed-use project, say in San Miguel, the smaller units would have a lower in lieu fee. The units that were under 900 square feet would have no in lieu fee or affordability requirement. And if they opt to make some of those units affordable by deed, then those would...
The doctor's hospital that he's building, you know, that the housing was owned by a different person, and it's just really small lot, single family homes going in there. Now it's tied economically or ordinance-wise to that big medical project in front of it, but there's absolutely no relation to it other than that. So that would be a mixed-use project, and that would seem like not the sort of thing we want to approve.
You know, the problem with mixed-use is it is like smart growth. It's whatever anybody wants to define it to be. We had a project before us a couple weeks ago that was four condominium units and 19 hotel units, and they were calling that mixed use. So, you know, there was no live-work component there, and there was no retail component there. So I prefer to just leave it as it is. And
one option you might have is actually what the staff report is recommending. The staff struggled with this issue as well for the same reasons that you are discussing. And that is, if there was a mixed use and you only thing that's being exempted is the commercial floor space in the development, then we are encouraging mixed use We had a limit in the ordinance, but we're still requiring inclusionary housing on the residential portion. Mm-hmm. And then down the road, if the county develops a tighter definition of what we think mixed use is, which we, I think, agree we need to do, then you can reconsider whether do you want to, if you have a good definition of mixed use, do you want to exempt the whole thing or not? But in the meantime, at least the residential component, we would be asking to comply.
I agree.
And you could make the residential units 899 square feet.
Right. And then the whole project is done.
Right.
But in the end result, those 900 square foot units are going to be more affordable.
Right.
Right.
Which is a good thing.
So that's fine.
They'd be very likely to be those live above the
shop. Are we making our own argument here, I guess?
Yes, multiple.
Okay. Consensus
multiple
is to leave
objectives.
It as it is then? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, the staff recommendation.
Finally, we got through something. Ah. Okay, did that capture all of the... Okay, so let's decide on something here. What we did? Going through the staff report. The homeowner fees, I kind of got the idea, in my opinion, there's not the darn thing we can do about them. I realize that's not...
That's not what we heard from county council.
Practically speaking.
No.
Without expending a lot of staff time.
Well, I'm Tim McNulty again, and as I said before, you know, we have sort of put our toe in the water of trying to tell homeowners associations how they need to operate, and so it's not beyond the realm of possibility that we could go further in. If we want to spend some more time working on that, I'm happy to look into that.
I kind of like staff's approach here. They're already, when they speak to the developers, they're telling them the advantages of it, and they're smart people. They'll try to make that happen because if it's going to be more money in their pocket, they have every incentive. Mm-hmm. True, county council will have the opportunity to look at it and said this is, impractical. There's not enough money being collected to pay for the maintenance of that drainage basin. So... I'm saying leave it as it is.
Well,
do I hear three votes for that?
I agree.
Now I got two.
I don't agree. I think that the staff's explanation or rationale doesn't speak to long-term affordability.
So
but
your solution
I don't,
would be what?
Well, I'm not sure I have a solution. I think that we could... take up the suggestion of our county council and look at including within our conditions of approval something that addresses the affordable units as part of that project. I don't know the answer to what it is because homeowner association fees are made up of various things. They aren't just detention basins, they're reserves, they're all kinds of things. But I'm certainly open to see if there's an opportunity there to create long-term affordability. Sorry.
Does that give you enough direction? That'd be a yes or a no.
Yes.
We think so. We
think so. Got it. Moving on to
I'm not saying there is a solution. I'm just saying that I think we have an opportunity here that might happen.
Okay. Moving on to the housing market areas. I, for one, like the new map. It's not perfect. Districts, are just too gerrymandered, and I'll use the grade as an example. To me, it's extremely logical to have some sort of geographical boundary, and your map on page 1-5 does recognize that, at least I'm...
What am I missing?
Non-sequitur there. You're connecting things that are not necessarily connectable. Just back to your San Margarita project, he's got to build two units. I'm not throwing out the fact that he could use them in Atascadero. Now, maybe he owns some land in San Miguel, and so that's where he would choose to put them. But I think, we're going to get to this later, but we should encourage them to be done in the cities by some method. Now, we can't force them.
Well, we could force them. I mean,
but we're not making that decision yet. We're just saying that Santa Margarita development is going to have its affordable component somewhere in this area.
And I'm saying we don't need either of these maps if we require that off-site units be built within the cities. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I don't like one map over the other. I don't think we need, I'm not ready to concede that we need a map because we haven't really given up on the question of requiring units to be built in the cities.
Well, let's take up that question then.
Okay.
And then we move on and move to the maps. I absolutely support the idea that we want to encourage this in the cities, but realistically, we don't have the authority to do that.
Right.
I think we can do it through incentives, and I think we've I've certainly suggested a couple. So for me, the absolute drop-dead requirement of within cities, even though I'd love to support it, I don't think it's real.
I would agree with that.
Well,
Gene?
I agree with
okay,
you.
Okay, so we lost
I'm
that
I'm sorry,
one.
Bob. I can't... We have to discuss this because the assumption that we can't require it, I don't think is a correct assumption. We can require in this ordinance whatever it is we think is appropriate. What it means in reality is that it's going to make it more difficult for a developer to provide off-site units because it's going to be more difficult to build them in Atascadero than it would be in San Miguel or Pozo. But I don't think that's a bad thing because ultimately, I mean, I'm assuming that we all still agree that the best case scenario and the whole fundamental underlying concept of inclusionary housing is to have the units built on site with the market rate units. That is essentially the definition of inclusionary housing. We're offering a lot of very generous alternatives to that. But if ultimately at the end of the day we agree that on site units are the best, we shouldn't be going to extraordinary lengths to make it easier and more affordable and faster and cheaper to build your units off site. Okay, you want to build your units off-site because you don't have room or it's a different style of development or whatever. If you're going to exercise that off-site option, well, by gosh, build it in a city with a sewer and a municipal water system and where people can walk to the store and get on the bus and all of those smart growth principles. And if you can't do that, oh, well, redesign your project and build them on site. But as we heard from the gentleman who testified earlier, builders don't want to build these units on site. Clearly, they're not going to do it unless we make it more difficult for them not to.
Okay, you made your point. Have you changed any votes?
No.
No, you lost. So...
Now we can talk about the map.
No. Let's finish the in the cities. To me, you're absolutely right. We can't require it, but I fully support the idea of incentivizing it.
No.
And we keep throwing the 15% number out, and I support that.
I do too. Yeah.
And do I hear three?
Yes.
Can I hear
for number for what?
If you take it away, Dana.
If you build them on
Dana's
site, you build
about.
Less. Is
correct.
That
correct.
Yeah.
So if it was a 20% requirement for inclusionary, you build the units on site, it's 15%. We could craft a parallel provision for the linkage if a commercial builder was going to build units on site or in a city to have a similar incentive.
That's what I support. And now let's define a city. Obviously, incorporated is one. What about urban areas? A.K.A. Templeton, Oceano, Los Osos.
I guess, and I know we will someday get there, but those areas that we consider urbanized still don't offer a lot of the infrastructure, amenities, transportation type things that I think are a real asset to it.
So... then there's like zero incentive to build them on site because the 15% to build them in the city is the same as the 15% to build them on site. And I'm not saying we should reduce the percentage that they have to build on site. I'm just pointing this out that, you know, in our ability to be excessively accommodating to the wishes of the building industry, we're creating situations where we're not necessarily going to be getting the kind of solutions that we set out in search of.
I don't see that as being accommodating the building industry. I see it as accommodating reality.
I agree with Bob, and I also see it as a way of encouraging affordable housing, in my opinion, which is the best place. But
I would agree with that. Okay, so now we got the city's...
I'm curious, too, now that... are we only offering, or are we only offering as one incentive the reduction, the 15%?
For on-site development, I think you're right. There is only one incentive for someone. No, I take that back. If someone built their affordable units on-site, they get a reduction from 15% requirement to 20% requirement. They get a one-to-one bonus, and they also get to ask for other incentives like a reduction in parking or setback.
Okay, so there are other incentives that if they chose to build them in a city, they would. But again, you know, we get into this mix. That's okay.
No. If it's inclusionary housing and you have a residential development and you're building the affordable units on site, you can ask for additional adjustments, if you will, to our development standards to make them fit.
Right.
If they're building it in a city, we don't really have much in the way of other incentives.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I guess that's kind of my point. Is there anything else we can do to really try and encourage that? I don't know the answer, but I'm...
We could go to 10%.
You could give them a one-to-one bonus.
You could give them
but you really can't give something to somebody else that you have no jurisdiction over.
How about a fire truck?
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're ready to move on to the housing market areas, a.k.a. the map. I like the map.
The housing market map that was suggested?
On page 1-5.
1-5?
I would agree.
Yeah, I don't see that the other two would work.
Okay. We've got three. Do we have four?
No, I think it's still problematic. I think we're going to see all of the affordable housing be built on the most remote, cheapest land in the county as a result of this.
Okay, then make their incentive 10%.
Where all the poorest people are going to have to drive miles and miles and miles to their jobs with paying $4 a gallon and more for gas. That's my prediction.
I got other predictions related to this, but I'm not going to share them right now. Okay, so that's at least three votes for the for your map on 1-5. Okay, moving on to the bottom of 1-6. Collecting the fees, and I think we really got to let that go until council weighs in to see if we can even do that.
I would agree.
Yeah, I agree.
And
do we want to talk about the average house size question or not?
Yeah, if it's a moot point, why bother?
Okay. So we will talk about the average house size assumptions when we hear back from staff about our ability to collect the fees?
If we cannot collect them until the time of occupancy, what's the point? Because we'll obviously know the size of the house then.
Yeah, then we know, yeah.
Well, again, that's creating what happens for those developers who subdivide the land and sell off the parcels to individual people who build individual homes which are exempt from this ordinance.
Answer that question, Mr. McNulty.
Sorry. I said, so what happens to those developers who subdivide their land and sell off the parcels to individual homeowners who build individual homes that are not subject to this ordinance? If we delay the fee until the building permits are pulled.
That's a good point. I'm going to need to try to address whether or not we can capture that problem. And I just need to spend a little more time looking at the
I think that's another ordinance. Argument for collecting the fee at the time the map.
But what he's suggesting...
I know, I realize that.
Well, you can make as many arguments as you want, but there are legal ramifications.
And exactly, and when our legal counsel is doing his research and coming up with his how he's going to best make his recommendation to us, I'm saying this so that he'll have those overall land use parcels, and I didn't have to pay anything, and none of the people who bought the parcels are going to have to pay anything.
That's why we know you wouldn't do that.
But I'm not the only one who thinks like that.
But you're absolutely right. And what's going to happen here, that the builders are going to figure a way around this. Mm-hmm. To me, it's the folly of doing the whole thing in the first place. In my opinion, we're completely wasting our time doing this. Because what the builders are going to do, they're going to seize upon that. They're going to take your 25 lots, or 5, whatever it was, and they're going to develop a parcel, but prior to going down to the building permit, they're going to say, yo, Mr. Citizen, would you want to buy this house? Great, here, you sign this contract, and you go down, and you get your building permit, and I agree, I'll build it just the way you want it according to this here plan, and you're not going to have to pay anything.
Well, that wouldn't work if you had to pay the fee at the time the map recorded.
I understand, but if we can't do it, why bother? But I'm just telling you.
We can do it.
I didn't realize you had a law degree.
So no, we'll resolve that issue the next time that you meet, and we can.
We're looking forward to
that meeting.
Okay. Anything on page 17? The commercial linkage fee, 20%, 10%.
I have a question for I think the consultant. I mean, staff is recommending now a 5% linkage fee. Are there any other jurisdictions who charge a 5% fee? That you know of?
This is a different consultant. This is the EIR consultant.
Oh, that's right. My apologies.
We have a limited budget for Marion Wolf to come down. And
my apologies.
So,
does staff know of any other?
We know of some jurisdictions. In fact, most jurisdictions have linkage fees. They're lower than what our 10% fee would have been. Whether they represent 5% of the legally justified maximum fee, I don't know. But we did notice that our proposal at 10% was quite a bit higher. Was it Sonoma County? Sonoma County that also had a kind of a 10%, and we weren't quite sure why. So at 10%, our linkage fees would have been higher than most of the jurisdictions we looked at and that our consultant looked at. There's a few, like San Francisco, that are higher. And based on that information and also on concerns expressed by the building industry, the staff is recommending we drop those by half to the 5% equivalent.
Well, the rationale that was given by the consultant was that the studies that were used were old, but I would perhaps suggest that they may relate more to the realities today, which we're getting. I mean, we certainly haven't dropped 2002 values, but we're certainly not at 2006 or 2007. So there is some rationale for looking at those studies as they stand and not saying they're old, because what's old has become now. Did I lose you folks?
No. You're saying the real estate took a downturn, and we recognize that.
You know, I could support, I mean, reluctantly, I could support going for a 5% linkage fee, but I would not support the four-year phase-in suggestion, because, you know, my thoughts on that are that it's never a good time to impose a fee. When you do it when the economy is low, is it a downturn? It's, you know, people are in the straits. And if you do it when the economy is beginning to recover, it's just, hey, we're just beginning to recover here. We need to get our feet back on the ground. And if you do it when times are good, it's like, hey, we've recovered. You know, if you impose these fees now, it's going to bring us back down into the dark days that we just got out of. And so, you know, I think a 5% fee is very, very minimal when you consider what, you know, the maximum justifiable fee would be. And you might as well just you know, say this is the fee and people can, you know, plan for it and understand it and get used to it, and, you know, they're not expecting one fee 1 year and then 2 years later it's like, oh, it's more than it was. And I think we should just, you know, rip the Band-Aid off all at once and take it.
I support the staff recommendation.
I do too. I do too.
I could go less. But I got to bring up one question, which is related to this. On page 143, now we're getting down to the ordinance. It's a little bit early before we're going into, you know, sentence by sentence. We're going to 143, and I read,
apply for a remodel permit. The under this proposed ordinance, the staff would look at what the new use is. If there was no change, if it was a real, if it was a retail use before and it's a retail use now, then there's no this no linkage fee would be collected. But what you just described is if in that building you went from a commercial service type use to a commercial retail use, which is cost more, then what staff would collect is the difference. Okay, I'm sorry, the other way around. So what staff would, if you went from a commercial retail use in that building to a commercial service use, staff would collect the difference, which would be
70 cents
on the foot.
Okay, even though the original commercial retail use instituted eons ago never paid any commercial linkage fee, that's better than I assumed it, but man, that's got to get complicated. How are you going to keep track of that? Every time somebody shows up because he needs to remodel, move a couple walls, get a new electrical thing, are we going to, because it's a new business now, are you going to look at that?
It's also complicated if we were to try to keep track of all the time somebody paid fees on a building as it went through different uses. It's better just to look at it today and say, okay, this is the change in use. You're going from retail to commercial, so let's collect the difference there.
What, I know I got to ask this, but what if we go from commercial service to commercial retail? Are you going to give me 70 cents a foot?
No.
I was going to put you in the same place.
Well, if you had collected it from the guy originally, it seems, not granted, you know, for this business that was established 10 years ago, no, but we put this, you don't know where I'm going.
We're not going
to
give him a refund.
No.
This is just getting too
Actually, Commissioner Rose,
it is pretty easy, pardon me, it is pretty easy to track when someone comes in for a business license for a change of use or change of occupancy. We look at that. We usually send an inspector out if there is a change in occupancy. So fairly easy to track that, and we would determine the adjusted fee at that time.
What constitutes a remodel?
Well, there's several different kinds of remodel. If it's a change of use, which is more on point to this your
right.
discussion this morning,
that
would be a change of occupancy, where an occupancy is changing to a more intensive employment type use, that would trigger this.
Right.
How are you going to figure that out?
It's easy. It actually is. When someone comes in for a business license, if it's a change of use, change of occupancy, an inspector would go out and look and determine if that building met that occupancy. We would then require, if it's change, we would require an architect to sign off on that. And it's through that process that we understand what changes might be necessary, and pretty easy to understand the change here.
The more I hear of this, the more I just...
The less...
Steph says he can do it. I trust him.
The less sense
it makes. I really would like to go back to my question on what constitutes a remodel, not the same question as a change in use. I guess I'm kind of under the impression that 50% or more, is that a definition that somewhere is written down?
If you're talking about when does a building permit triggered, it's... So that's in the building code, and there's, I think...
I'm reading our suggested ordinance, and it uses the word remodel. That's on page 1-43 that Bob had originally referred
to. It's remodeling it into a different use.
No, it doesn't.
That's
it says remodel or convert.
Convert an existing commercial industrial structure into a different commercial industrial use. So if you're remodeling your carpet shop because, you know, you just want a different look and you still are going to keep it your carpet shop, this would not kick in,
okay.
Right?
Okay,
correct.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And they're saying only if I went from a carpet shop to a...
To a bar.
Yeah, to bar.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Before we dismiss that this doesn't really matter, I went to page 152 and 153, and they were talking about amortizing the 3 cents per square foot. On page 153, that last paragraph, and it said that equaled a monthly rent increase of $300. That's no small amount.
I have decided that's what I like. I like
You like the staff recommendation.
Yeah.
And I agreed with you, except I wanted to go lower, but I didn't think I could get support for that.
Well, and then the phase-in, I agree that, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, you're on page 1-7.
Yeah, right at the bottom.
The smaller commercial projects below 5,000 square feet are exempt, phased into a four-year period,
mm-hmm.
linkage fees reduced from 10 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a phase-in, so the first year it's...
Yeah.
And I could agree with that, Gene. Is there two more votes for that?
Sure.
Okay, that's three. Ms. Rappa?
Oh, I suppose I'm not convinced any of what we're doing is going to work.
Well, I would agree, too.
I agree with that.
Well, to that end, you know, we're getting up to our two-plus hour limit.
And here's what I'm thinking of. I talked to staff and the applicant for the last item. I don't think that's going to take longer than 15 minutes. Is there anybody from the public who want to speak to the next item, the Hare and Crest? I'm seeing a head nod yes.
Before we leave this item, I had one thing
I know that. So I'm saying we should quit this at 11:45 and take up the item 2 at that time.
And you think that's going to take 15 minutes?
I agree. It's going to take 15 minutes.
That's fine if you have
and
a plan.
I consulted with staff and the applicant before I came up with that scientific...
So we're going to go along for another half hour.
Okay, but did you...
Well, sure. I mean, I can do this. I can do this now. I think at this point it's fair to say that we all have misgivings about how this ordinance is going to work from various perspectives. I know some people think it's too onerous. I personally don't think it's strong enough. But at any rate, we know we're sort of treading on, ground that we're not familiar with here. And I would like to propose adding the following language to the ordinance so that we can track our progress and see how it's working. The planning director shall prepare an annual report to the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors at an agendized public hearing, detailing the progress made toward providing affordable units in the previous calendar year. The Planning Commission may make recommendations to the Board on how this section should be amended to better meet the purpose statement in 22.12.080. All that is language asking for an annual report, a progress report on the program.
Staff want to comment on it?
Yes, thank you, Chuck Stevenson. That could be easily accommodated. We do prepare an annual report. We do bring that annual report. It's an annual report on the general plan, progress, and implementation, so it would be fairly easy to include that as part of that. We do bring that to your commission and late in the year and then on to the board.
The full general plan report.
But we do have to report on the amount of affordable housing that has been built in the previous year as part of our requirements. So I think...
So what you're saying is you'd be gathering that information anyway.
Yes.
This language would sort of call out that particular piece of it and require a separately agendized discussion of the affordable housing.
And if maybe Mr. Lilly would like to respond.
Actually, that sounds fine. We're required by state law to report to the state on progress to towards our housing element goals as well, and we fold that information into the annual general plan report. So it's not like it would be more work.
Right.
And I was going to ask if the clerk got your precise words so that we can bring that back when we see you next time.
She'll give it to her once she erases all my chicken scratching off of it. is there consensus for that? Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing 1, 2, 3, 4 heads nodding yes. Okay, back to you, Mr. Bench. Did we have any more bullets that we needed to give you direction on before we move on to the EIR?
Actually, I'd like to take this opportunity, if we could go on to page 1-8 and finish out 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8.
4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Okay.
These are possible provisions that could be added to the linkage fee ordinance to help give the developers more flexibility. We talked about number 4, mixed-use projects.
Okay, do we have... Do we have 4 votes for that?
What?
Item 4?
I think you did already.
I think we did, too.
Okay, we did.
Yeah.
I agree. Okay, moving on to 5, then.
Yes. 5 would be allowing alternative methods to be used to meet the affordable housing requirement, such as allowing the affordable units to be built on or off-site, accepting land donations, or giving credit to housing... employee housing or credit to employee housing programs. Again, we can add this to the...
To an employee housing program. I mean, you know, a developer could say, oh, I'm going to have this great employee housing program and here's what it's going to be, and we'll say, oh, great, great, okay, you're off the hook, and then 2 years later, you know, are we checking up on that? No, we're not.
Yes, we would. The units would be deed restricted. We would need a written agreement with the developer, I would assume recorded on the property where the development is happening, that ensures this will happen. I mean, and we already have a draft, well, we're already doing it, but we have a draft improvement to our monitoring program, because if this passes and applies to a lot of projects, we're going to have a lot more deed restricted units we have to keep track of.
Okay.
We can't.
This says the solar plant out in Carissa Plains, that they build some employee housing there. You're going to deed restrict that house so it's always for the people that work there.
We would deed restrict it if they want credit for affordable units.
Okay. Okay, so do we have, I heard 3 heads nodding yes for 5. Do we have 4?
The staff think that's a good idea? I mean, I know this has been proposed by, you know, a third-party interest.
We're trying
to accommodate those interests.
We're recommending it, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got 4 then.
Yeah.
Ah, good. Number 6, Ted. Commercial could be modified to make room for on-site affordable housing.
Number 6 is similar to what the draft ordinance offers for residential development, that a developer can ask for some design modifications to make his affordable units fit. That's, again, an incentive that can be added in the ordinance if your commission chooses.
Mm-hmm. Incentives, I'm for that.
Okay.
That's 2.
Yes.
3.
Yep.
4.
Okay.
So we got 4 votes saying yes on 6. Number 7.
Number 7, we could lower the affordable requirement for on-site housing. So, again, similar to the residential project, if a commercial developer decides to meet his affordable housing requirements by building on-site units, we could consider reducing the affordability requirement. A mixed-use project would be a good example. If a developer finds that he's building a project with commercial floor space and residential area that has 5 commercial units on it, or 5 residential units, and he made one of those residential units an affordable unit, he would meet his affordability requirement.
Works for me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, we've got four yeses for that one. Next one.
Number eight, which talks about
number
the
eight.
Time of payment. I would agree with the suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute. That was the...
No, because they're talking about the linkage fees, not the
okay.
The other fees.
But county council's pushing his button here.
That would be acceptable the way that's worded. That, as I was saying earlier, this is actually the presumption of when the fee would be paid in number eight.
Right.
So.
Okay. So we have one, two, three, four yeses for number eight?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else, Mr. Bench?
No.
Okay. Then let's...
I guess the part that that I don't see in here, and we discussed it, and we all, you know, gave our druthers to whether or not we could somehow include a countywide solution, but we don't even have anything that addresses that at all. I mean, we don't even have the idea that we try and establish some type of or use an existing organization to, I mean, kind of give up.
What? I'm missing what you're saying there.
Well, as you move down the page, and you're looking, I'm still on page 1-8. I thought you were moving off of that page and the countywide solution.
The gist of that is that a countywide solution, such as new taxes or increase in existing taxes, is going to take a vote, a public vote. If your commission feels inclined, you can ask staff or direct staff to take this forward to the board as a recommendation that the board consider telling staff to start the work that it takes to put a ballot measure together to increase taxes.
You know,
it must be I got to rethink my position.
Actually, staff is very happy with the amount of direction you've given us. I think we can make changes to the draft ordinance, get some research that we and county council need to do, and bring that back to you on May 22nd, if that's the date.
Okay.
You're comfortable with.
Okay. Now I'd like to spend 15 minutes talking about the revised EIR.
Does that make more sense, or does it make more sense to spend 15 minutes actually going through the substance of the ordinance?
Well, I'm hoping to get a couple ideas out that staff's going to come back and give us more information. I was already talking to the consultant on a break that I want to say what I told him out in public.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I got a big problem that I need an answer to, and maybe I missed it all. And I'm sure Mr. Wynn has got something to say.
I only have, I'm really sorry, but I just have a couple of additional questions. If others agree with me that we aren't really spreading the responsibility for affordable housing amongst everyone, how do we relate that concern to the board?
By voting no on this whole package.
Well,
which is what I intend to do so far.
So, I'm really asking for a way. First we need to say, do others agree that this is not an equitable solution?
Yes. Absolutely, yeah.
How do we at least suggest alternatives?
Well, alternatives or additional measures?
Additional measures.
In our final vote, we're going to say, you know, we have the opportunity to say whatever we want to at that point.
Yeah, I would, you know, we could probably send a letter of transmittal to the board and say, you know, we've done the best we can with this, and we hope it works, and we realize that this is, you know, only one piece of a much larger problem, and there's many other things that could be done, including da-da-da-da-da-da, and we hope your board will consider them.
Staff would suggest that perhaps a second motion. You'll vote on this ordinance, and then a second motion could include
when we take this up.
What Commissioner Christie is alluding to, and we could prepare something like that for you to look at.
Okay.
Right, because I want to be engaged in this discussion, although I think this whole idea is completely wrong-headed, and it's especially the commercial portion of it is just doesn't make any sense at all. But I'm not going to sit here and fold my hands and not be part of the discussion, because if it goes forward, I want it to be as fair and as incentive-based as possible. But don't kid yourself, I'm not supporting it. But
tell us how you feel, Bob.
But I haven't heard all the evidence yet, so I couldn't change my mind. So
okay, let's move on then to the EIR. That was my question.
Well,
Thank you.
If we move to the EIR, when are we going to get? Because the bulk of my energy has gone towards analysis and comments and suggestions on the language of the ordinance itself. So
when we get the final ordinance, which is, well, the next revision, save those comments. We're not going to get all through that today because I have several also.
Okay.
Okay.
But let's just do the EIR.
I'm already toting around so many versions of this thing. I guess I'll just tote around another version. That's fine.
Yeah, just think of it as kind of like an area plan update that goes on forever.
Absolutely.
Okay, can we briefly introduce why you saw fit to make this document?
Sure, Jeff Oliveira, planning staff. What you have before you is the revised final EIR, which is the final EIR for the revised draft that was circulated. If you recall, when we did the original EIR, the original draft EIR, and circulated it, and we published the original final EIR, there were specific issues and concerns raised, in particular by NAPOMO and at subsequent Planning Commission hearings. In particular, there was updated water availability and use data, in particular as it relates to WP Water Planning Area 6, NAPOMO, which was identified as having a level of severity 3 for water availability. In addition to other areas in the county, in particular Water Planning Area 1 on the North Coast and Water Planning Area 3, Los Osos and Morro Bay, having similar level of severities for water availability. And as a result, the impacts for water resources after updating the information were changed from a Class 2 to a Class 1 impact. So that triggered the recirculation.
Public comment in, and then Mr. Wynn is my only speaker slip. Anyone else wants to talk about the EIR, come on up. Mr. Wynn, you're first.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Mike Wynn. I'm speaking for the NAPOMO Community Services District, and I thank you for listening to me one more time on this. It's our view that this final revised EIR does not meet the standard required by CEQA, possibly because a report of adequate dimensions was thought to be too expensive and thus not authorized. For example, our letters 2 and 3, one from the district general manager and the second from me, said that environmental demands are missing from the tables on sections 4.10-9 through 4.10-13. The response simply says these numbers are unknown and CEQA does not allow us to speculate. It's true that CEQA does not allow you to speculate. CEQA does not let you say that since I don't know the answer, I can't say. You simply must do the analysis. Ignorance is not a defense against exploring and finding out the answers. These analyses must be made according to the law, and we have some data in this county with stream gauges that could get us started, but there's been no effort made here. Secondly, both letters 2 and 3 say the CEQA requirement per vineyard interpretation says that those making the GPA, in this case the county, must mitigate if possible. The report response back says that no individual projects exist at this time, so estimating water demand would be speculative. This is not so. This GPA itself is a project within the legal definition of the term. And it does have data on which these estimates can be made. It's the general plans for each of the planning areas which tell you what the density is and what they're zoned for, and from that you can definitely extrapolate, not speculate, as to what kind of water demands should be done. And you do it every day already. Your planning department does this constantly. Further, the report claims that mitigation measures identified in the EIR were designed to meet all CEQA demands. This is simply not so. The original EIR had a blend of two responses. One, denial that the problem was significant. And secondly, saying that where it was significant, future development would take care of the mitigations. This is specifically prohibited in Vineyard, and mitigation is possible and it's necessary. It's not cheap. And we are exploring with your decision makers on another level that we might form a general plan, a JPA, a joint powers agreement, that we could work together with the county to mitigate. And other areas in the county might do so as well. But these do have mitigations. They do have potential solutions. Now, in this revision, there's a third response added to denial and passing the buck, and that is saying that that these are consistent with the build-out potential anticipated under the county's general plan, and then goes on to say that if water's not there, that this could not be mitigated. These could be Class 1 impacts. Again, these are new demands. Now, weasel words consistent with is not what it's really to the point. These are new demands which are, in fact, created by this general plan amendment. And therefore, it is your obligation to find the mitigations for those and to work with the rest of us to do exactly that. So for these reasons and others, the time does not permit me to explore. We would simply say that we wish that you would not certify this. You would not recommend its certification, that you would take it back, take one more run at it, and I can understand that you don't want to do this. It's a lot of time. By the way, it's possibly more money. My only response to that is my best guess is it's going to take a great deal more time if we try to certify and go ahead with a defective document. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, close the public hearing, and before you answer Mr. Wynn in the 5 minutes we have left, I'm looking at the mitigation measures starting on 4-10-18. Proof of water supply, and you say, as a mitigation measure, future applicants subject to the Affordable Housing Office ordinance shall provide proof of an adequate, safe, and continuous supply of water to the proposed project. Well, see, what the heck? We've got to do that anyway. I mean,
rather than mislead the public that we have a definitive answer, that to do that based on the data we have would be speculation. The commenter is correct that if we were to go back and gather that data, you'd be gathering the data for several different water planning areas. It would be time-consuming. It would be expensive. Best we can do now with the data that we have is what's presented in the final EIR. With regard to mitigation measures and them being designed to meet demand, as you mentioned, the proof of water supply is required. What's been added as part of the final EIR here, the revised final, are additional statements regarding how that will be established. It's the second paragraph of mitigation measure WR-1A. Where it's stated that additional residential development within areas designated as level of severity 3, which are water planning areas 1, 3, and 6, shall not be allowed unless the local agency responsible for ensuring adequate water supply determines that there is available water to meet long-term needs of the area in question. This determination will be based on the outcome of water master planning efforts. So there's a new layer of a requirement for a burden of proof. In addition, there's an additional mitigation measure, WR1B, which requires water conservation measures to be applied as mitigation to individual projects under this program. But overall, the impact that we are identifying is tied to the county's existing water master planning efforts, which designate these level severity areas. And we are acknowledging now as part of the revised final that in areas with level severity 2 or 3, that is areas that have an existing deficiency or are projected to have a deficiency in the next 5 to 7 years, we are acknowledging now that even with this mitigation to require proof of water supply, it still may be difficult to do that, just on the fundamental fact that the current data shows that there's a problem in, or will be a problem in those areas. And that's why we are now in a position to, if this goes forward, require a statement of overriding considerations for the project.
Is it possible, and you can say no, is it possible to briefly summarize for us what those data gaps are and what we would need to do in order to fill them?
Well, what we're talking about is riparian demand. So the demand that a river or stream has, in order to feed that flow, you need a certain amount of the overall water supply in a water planning area. In certain areas, there's been some stream gauge data that accounts for a basic idea of what that volume might be. But in order to have more definitive information, you'd have to go study that longitudinally over time, over a wet season.
So we would literally need to go and install water gauges that aren't currently there. It's not that the data's not available because we couldn't gain access to it. The data's not available because it hasn't been generated
That's my understanding. I could throw that back to staff potentially. As I understand it, as part of the conservation element update that's happening in parallel with this, that is one of the tasks as part of that effort. So that data, I don't know, again, definitively, if that data is going to become available as part of that process. But if it does, that could potentially be wrapped up into this.
Okay, with that, we're motion to continue to May 22nd.
So moved.
Second. All those in favor signify saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. It's unanimous. Continue this on May 22nd. Could we introduce the next hearing item, please?
Hearing to consider a request by Heron Crest Development for a third time extension of development plan coastal development permit. County file number D020201D. Supervisorial District 4, Carrie Brown, project manager.
Good morning, Carrie Brown, County Planning Staff. And just take me a minute to get it up here.
Oof, there it is.
The applicant is requesting a third time extension for development plan D020201D, an affordable housing plan unit development, consisting of 3 single-family dwellings, approximately 1,600 square feet, with 600 square foot garages. This project was approved on June 12, 2003. Proposed project is located on Air Park Drive in the community of Oceano. The site is zoned residential multifamily. This is an aerial view of
conditions for affordability. I didn't find them in the.
Maybe the applicant will have to answer that one, too.
Well, I think the first condition, the approved development authorized it as an affordable housing project. And so when they come through this process through building permits, that's where we'll do the verification that the affordable housing deed restrictions are in place.
But if there's no conditions for deed restrictions, then there wouldn't be any requirement for them to produce those deed restrictions.
This is an affordable housing project that was required as part of a previous tract approval.
Okay.
And was conditioned as part of that tract to provide affordable housing units.
So shouldn't, if this is getting its own separate standalone permit, maybe this is a question for County Council, maybe it was just an oversight that there were no deed restrictions as part of the conditions for the project, and maybe we can rectify that oversight now.
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I think that the point that Carrie's trying to make is that anything that came through that didn't have deed restrictions wouldn't be in substantial conformity with what had been approved and wouldn't be able to be finalized.
And maybe I'm confused. If this is a requirement of a separate project, but it's now being processed as a standalone project.
Because it's off-site, presumably.
Right. I mean, if I was a new plan check person, I wouldn't know that. And so I would just be going, oh, you met this condition, you met that condition, okay, you're good to go. There's nothing in the conditions for this permit that reflect whatever affordability requirements were in the master permit. So I think it might be prudent for us to pick that up, whatever that is, in terms of the deed restrictions, and add it as a condition to this permit. Otherwise, I could see it falling through the cracks.
Can we, and since we have reference to the original approval, could that be referenced?
It's not, what I think Commissioner Christie's saying is the affordable housing requirement is not a condition in the previous development plan. It was in the tract for San Luis Bay Estates that this was a requirement from.
So all I'm saying, it seems like a simple request. Let's just add a condition today to this particular project, which we're going to extend the map, and say at the time of recordation, you need to have a recorded deed restriction for, you know, whatever our standard language is for deed-restricted affordable units.
Well, I suppose the other consequence is that, perhaps this could go forward as something that's not an affordable housing project, but that they wouldn't satisfy the obligation that they've incurred to provide affordable housing on their other project. Nevertheless, these three houses could still be approved as this project, right, without... You understand what I'm saying? If, for example, they went through without deed restrictions,
yeah,
somehow the worst case happens that you're anticipating, then the answer would be that they simply haven't satisfied the condition that was placed on the larger project that required them to produce off-site affordable housing.
And they're out of compliance with that permit.
And that they'd still have to come in to do that in order to be in compliance with that permit.
Well, and they may, or they may not, or it may turn into a big snarled legal battle or a big enforcement issue. It just seems like to me a very simple proactive correction to make to require these three units to be deed restricted for affordability. I don't know what the problem is.
Well, I think they are going to be deed restricted for affordability as provided by the code section. There's an exemption depending upon the cost of what it sells for. This is an old subdivision and an old development plan that had a requirement that the subdivider provide affordable housing, and then these houses, I think, are being built to satisfy that requirement, and there's a requirement that there be an affordable housing agreement entered into unless there's an exemption available, and there may be an exemption available here depending upon what the price is.
So I'm not hearing that there's an exemption. I'm hearing that this is an affordable unit, an affordable project, and it's being built as a condition of a prior approval. And so all I'm saying is in order to ensure that these units do get rented or sold to qualified affordable homebuyers or renters, I think if we're going to extend the map today, it would be prudent for us to add that as a specific condition for this project, for this permit, that they be affordable. That's all.
Okay, got that said. Let's get the applicant up here, unless there's any other questions, and maybe he can shed light on all this.
We're working on it, and it took us a while to come up with something that would work next to existing houses, because, there's a lot of different things you can do, but some of them don't work as well if you're right next to an existing house that also might be subject to liquefaction, too.
Yeah, and that was my question, was are the changes to the foundation, are they going to require an amendment to the permit? Are they going to substantially change the, the grading requirements or the structural?
No, they'll change the actual foundation plans, that's all. They won't be changing any of the things that are being listed in
here. Okay.
Yeah.
And this doesn't need a condition or anything, because as you go to the Public Works Department, they know all this stuff, and they'll check that it meets the new
needs. It's the building department, and they're the ones that actually have speared this along.
Okay. Now, can you speak to affordability?
I don't know that much about it. I was going to leave the people that know more about it than I do.
Okay.
This is the, you know, the parts that I do know, this is intended to be used for the San Luis Bay Estates for their affordable units. I know of no reason why it wouldn't go through or anything like that. They're required to have the three units. It's a requirement of San Luis Bay. So, you know, whether it's these or something else, oh, and it has to be in the coastal zone, too. That was one of the requirements also we had.
You have enough knowledge to have an idea what these would sell for?
No, I don't have.
And they're currently, the property, the parcel, I mean, you're the representative. The owner is the San Luis Bay Estates?
No, it's BDC Development.
So it's a private development?
Yes. Yes, it is. Private development.
Okay.
This is an example of the off-site.
I know, that's fine. I get it, and I'm just saying...
And it's in an urban area.
That's all great. I'm just saying it's also an example of how we need to make sure that what we think we're approving as affordable units or requiring to be built as affordable units get actually maintained.
We got that. Okay, anyone else?
Could I just add that...
Well, let me see if there's anyone else in the public. Is anyone else in the public that wishes to address the commission on this matter? They're thinking about it. Yes, no? Shaking their head, no. Okay, I'll close the public hearing. Bring it back to the commission for disposition, and Mr. Orton.
Jim Orton from County Council's office. I just wanted to indicate there is an agreement with the subdivider on this to provide these units off-site, and that's been approved by the plan director. And this development here are the off-site units. The agreement that they've entered into require an affordable housing agreement with the new owners that will have the restriction on, unless there's an exemption available if they're sold at a low enough price. So in order to satisfy that agreement, they need this approved, and then the new owner enters into an affordable housing agreement with the county that has the restrictions on them. So I think what you're worried about is already covered.
But it's not reflected anywhere. This is the permit, essentially. This is creating the subdivision of the land and allowing these structures to be built with the assumption that they're going to be affordable units. We're extending the life of this permit today, which is fine, but whether it was an oversight, or it just wasn't how we did things back then, or it was just an unusual arrangement that we didn't quite know how to deal with, doesn't really matter. What matters today is we have before us a track map extension for three affordable units, and there is nothing in the permit there is no condition that requires them to be affordable. Yes, this developer has some agreement with the former, subdivider of the property as a permit of their project or condition of their project. It's not reflected in this track map as a condition, and we have an opportunity to correct that today.
It does seem to me, again, I find myself agreeing with you. Mr. Stevenson, did you have a solution for this? Perhaps some words you could stick somewhere?
We do have some draft language that Mr. Robeson can share.
Thank you, Bill Robeson, County Planning staff. We just have a simple one-liner that Chuck made up. And it can be just said that all units...
Where are you?
Where
are you
going? We're on page 2-37.
Three.
And we would have it...
Wait a minute, don't go that fast.
2-37.
3-7. Exhibit B, conditions
Exhibit
of approval.
Exhibit B, conditions of approval. And we would have it as probably number 7, a new number 7 under covenants, conditions, and restrictions.
New 7.
And then renumbering, correct?
Right.
237.
Could you comment on that? The other, Mr. Orton.
Why don't you have it affordable housing restriction as required by the code, and then if they meet the exemption of the code, then they don't need the agreement. If they don't meet the exemption, then they do.
And how would the words now read then?
Required by the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance.
But the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance doesn't have an affordability requirement in it.
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does.
It does?
That's where this is coming from.
Oh, okay. This is simple, and it seems like...
But if they sell for $100,000 each, you know, they're looks like they're affordable to anybody, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And let's
so
not
great.
Muddle up the water with a bunch of 35-year agreements.
But, well, yeah, because somebody could buy them for $100,000 and sell them the next month for $300,000. That's the whole point of having a deed-restricted unit.
Yeah, but the purpose of the regulations that we're operating under was to allow that if they're sold at affordable price, that there's no reason to have the deed restriction in. That was the understanding previously when the regulations were put into effect. And I believe that was the reasoning behind the exemption that's in the ordinance.
This is getting way, it seems like a really simple thing. It's getting way too complicated for me to follow. I like the language staff suggested, and I move approval as amended.
I have one quick question. We've always been told on time extensions you cannot change any of the conditions.
Well, this is not a track mac. This is a development plan.
Yeah. Right. But it's a time extension.
Yeah, yep. But it's a development plan, not a track mac.
There are different rules that apply.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I'm not hearing a second to Commissioner Christie's motion, so...
Reese, what was the motion?
She wanted to do it as the original wording.
I'm just saying well, approve as amended per staff.
And what is that wording per staff? Could you read it again?
All units shall be subject to a deed restriction for long-term affordability.
I would say as required by the San Luis Obispo County Code.
But that's not her
that
motion.
That would be my recommendation. That's not what the motion is. But
okay.
I think that's the problem I was thinking about was if there's an exemption built into the code that it applies.
Okay. Got on long enough, dies for lack of a second. Is there a second motion? And did you want to read that into the record again, Mr. Orton or Mr. Robinson?
Sure.
New condition 7.
New condition 7 that includes Mr. Orton's last addition?
Yeah. Read it.
We have the section from the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance up, so what we were just going to add that section number to Mr. Orton's suggestion. So it would read all units...
I would suggest that you just use the San Luis Obispo County Code.
His thing, I think what he's trying to say is this was in 2003. Am I correct? And
I believe things have
changed a bit.
Okay. Jim, can you read it into the record then?
Well, Mr. Robinson, would you please read what you originally read?
So, all units shall be subject to deed restriction for long-term affordability.
As required by the San Luis Obispo County Code.
So moved.
You got that there, Ramona?
Yeah.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. Roll call.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. And with that, we're adjourned for lunch. We'll come back at 1:30 and take up item number 3. Okay, I'll call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission for April 24th back in session. And we are now about to commence hearing item number 3, which is?
Hearing to consider a request by MKT Investments to allow for wastewater for lots from Tract 2368, construction of two 10,400 square foot commercial service buildings and limitation on uses. County file number DRC 2006-00214, Supervisorial District 3, Project Manager John McKenzie.
Land use categories of the entire development is commercial service. Around Track 2368 includes agriculture, commercial service, industrial, and public facilities. This aerial shows the relationship between the proposed wastewater facility, which is the Fierro Mutual Water Company, to the northwest or the upper left corner of the picture, as it would be providing service to the Track 2368. Another aerial zooming in, showing Lot 10 of the development. As you can see, most of the tract improvements are in at this point. And one last closer in shot of Aileen Way and Kendall Road within the tract itself. Site plan showing the layout of the proposed structures. And a landscaping plan that shows the proposed landscaping around the buildings and the perimeter of the property. Here's the elevation, which is using the modern agrarian style of architecture. The upper elevation shows the front of the building, the middle one shows the side, and the lower one showing the rear of the building. Photos. This is taken approximately from Highway 227, looking east towards the site from Kendall Road. This one's a little closer up at the corner of Aileen Way and Kendall Road. And this last one is looking the other direction back towards Highway 227. The two of the main issues dealt with visual concerns. The tract included a number of conditions that dealt with visual issues, and as I mentioned, in this case, the applicant prepared an architectural design guideline that would be applied towards the entire tract, and for this particular lot, they've chosen the modern agrarian design, which I've shown you the elevations. Staff agrees with this proposed design, thinks it's well done. The other issue relates to water availability. Per the previous tract, a detailed water study was prepared by a hydrogeologist, which did identify limited water availability. With that in mind, as far as potable water goes, some limitations were applied to this project as it relates to the types of uses that would be allowed to limit the more water-intensive type use. Staff recommends that the Commission adopt the negative declaration and amend the conditional use permit for the tract and approve the new conditional use permit based on the findings and conditions listed in Exhibits A and B. And that would conclude staff's presentation.
Questions? Commissioner Rappa?
No.
Gene?
No.
Well, I got to have one.
Got one.
Condition 23, which is on page 39, and it looks like it came out of the mitigation summary table on 340, 341, and I didn't quite get all that. What are we trying to achieve here? Obviously, water efficiency, but evidently they got so much water available, they got 100 pieces of pie, and these guys get 2 pieces. But we can bank it, and how's all that work?
I'll take a stab at it, and the applicant can help probably as well. The intent here was to, as I mentioned, there is a water availability issue, and the intent here was to identify how much water is, you know, guaranteed outright for the development. The applicant did raise the issue that, you know, certain uses within the development may not need all of their allotment, and therefore we should develop some program that would allow for
some flexibility if that water is not being used from another development, that it could be banked, as you indicated, and used for another lot. So when you have a certain use that may want more water or need more water for in the short term, it'd be available to them. And so the intent here was to provide that flexibility, but not to permanently lock it up in the event that the lot that was giving it away did have some ability to retain it if they did change use in the future. So with that, it did make it kind of a complicated condition. So
who's going to referee all this? I hope not the county.
Well, the county will be receiving a report to that effect. You know, as I think is in the condition that we'll receive a report of water usage and who's using what water, the type of toilet that's available commercially that has two handles. And
one for a little business, one for big business?
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. All right. I learned something today. Okay. A number one handle and a number two handle.
There you go.
Okay. Okay. Questions? None? Okay. Public hearing. Open up to the applicant, to the applicant's agent.
I'm afraid to follow that chairperson Rose. Good afternoon, Chairman Rose, members of the commission. I'm Carol Florence. I'm a principal planner with Oasis Associates, and I'm here this afternoon representing the applicant, MKT Investments. I just want to acknowledge that the T part of MKT, Neil Tardif, is in the audience, as well as Rob Miller with the Wallace Group, who operates the Fiero Lane Mutual Water Company. I thought if there were any questions at all, that Rob would be able to address those, whether it be dual flush or purple pipe, et cetera. This afternoon, of course, I'm going to respectfully request that you adopt the negative declaration and approve CUP DRC 2006-00214 and amend CUP S507U based upon the findings in Exhibit A and the 49 conditions in Exhibit B. I want to thank John for being extremely thorough in his analysis, and I just wanted to let you know that he and I have been working on this particular commercial subdivision since 2001. So John probably knows the project as well as I do, if not better in some circumstances. I just wanted to give you, and I'm going to try to be brief here, I just wanted to give you a sense of the serious effort and the capital expenditure that went into this project. My firm started with this in 1999. That's when the Morabito brothers and our Burke families got together and combined their individual properties that now total 58 acres to master plan the property. And I thought that in itself, taking a rather substantial piece of property and looking at the big picture as well as the details, was a really commendable move on their particular part. And I'll digress for a moment and introduce Brian Starr with Studio Design Group, who is our project architect. So, as you can imagine, it took a number of years to really understand, if you will, the technical environmental lay of the land. One really interesting aspect of this project that has nothing to do with today, but I just want to bring forward to you because I think it represents the ability of differing opinions to come together for a common goal. Early on, we determined, without understanding the traffic aspects of this project on the Broad Street corridor, we were going to go nowhere with this project. So we formed what we called the 227 Task Force. It included SLOCOG, Caltrans, the airports manager, the City of San Luis Obispo, the County of San Luis Obispo, the Morabito Burks, as well as the SenGlick project. And you may have seen this project recently, that we were concurrently developed with them. They had a development plan, we had a map, and they're on our northern boundary. After 3 years of sitting around, and if you've ever been to a Caltrans meeting, more Caltrans people than the rest of us, but nonetheless, we were able to conclude what the corridor was going to actually look like all the way from Orchid to Price Canyon. And it also bound my clients and the airport to align their roadways that will have a future signal. And that roadway is kind of the secondary access for the airport expansion, which will be right across from Farmhouse Lane. I could go on and on, but suffice it to say, in 2003, and I think Commissioner Rose and Commissioner Malskow will remember, you approved the tentative tract map and the conditional use permit. Since that time, as John showed you in the slides, we've completed the tract improvements and the map has been finaled. Another interesting fun fact, in January of 2006, the City of San Luis Obispo recommended and LAFCO approved putting this and a number of properties into their sphere of influence. We were still, at that point, designing, if you will, saw an opportunity to potentially work with the city, and probably for over nine months, worked very diligently with the city's administrative staff and utility staff to determine if they had the ability to serve the project. Although we were on the same side of the table and there was really truly a willingness to make this happen on both sides, timing became an issue. They were not able to service us collectively.
Okay, so Fierro has the ability to treat to tertiary.
They will on our site, but they will be operating our system, and Rob can speak to that if you have any other detailed questions. But as you know, the bulk of water use tends to be in landscaping, and from the landscape architecture side of me, this is definitely the way to go. Not only environmentally, because we're not using groundwater, but it just makes a whole lot of sense. So with that said, the only other thing we're asking you to do is approve the project, and I'm more than happy to have you be the Architectural Review Commission today, but I'll just tell you that Chuck Stevenson, who was a former City of San Luis Obispo Architectural Review Commissioner, worked with John and Brian and I to come up with the building elevations that John showed you earlier. So we believe this to be the start of a very, very attractive project, and the start, hopefully, to set the stage for the balance of any development within the tract. With that said, I'm just going to ask you again for your approval. I'm here to address any of your questions or concern, and I'm sure that Rob and Brian would be more than happy to do the same. Thank you.
Sure. Where's the airplane emergency landing area?
Maybe John could put that slide back up. Good memory, Chairman Rose.
They wrote it down for me here.
Oh. Actually, if you look closely, thanks, John, for pointing that out, that roadway is substantially wider than any of the other tracked roadways.
So somehow somebody taken off and has a problem, they need that, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Work that out with the Airport Land Use Commission.
Okay.
Thanks for asking, though.
And more about the purple pipe. Now, you already got the pipe in, or you're in the process of putting it in.
Yes.
And the water's going to come from what? Where on this map here? Ooh, go back to the map you just had up there, John. Where's the sewage treatment plant, more or less?
The plant itself, I believe, is up in this area. There's also some treatment facilities that are on this corner of the overall tract. And there's an existing line in place to the tract at this time.
And all of the non-city stuff we have here is run by this Fierro Water Company?
That's correct.
Well, no,
I'm sorry. What's the question? I'm sorry,
the airport are served by the city.
Oh, yes, that's correct. I'm sorry,
so
I misunderstood.
It's a combination of both.
Okay, but your mic's not on. We have no idea what you're saying.
He can answer it certainly better than I can.
Yeah, the airport is served by the city. It's proper. All of the airport facilities, there is an agreement with the city to provide services, water, and I believe sewer.
For a long time.
Okay.
Yes.
And this gentleman is going to add 2 cents here?
Chairman, Rob Miller with the Wallace Group and the general manager of the low water company out there. Just to confirm that John had the location correct and the purple pipe is installed. We're currently treating the secondary and have been doing that for about 8 years. And one of the facilities needed to go to tertiary is a filtration system and then a disinfection system, and that will be on the lot 13 of the proposed tract. And that will treat it to tertiary, and then we'll have that water available for beneficial reuse and landscape irrigation.
So the water that's secondary treated, it now percolates through some ponds or something back into the groundwater basin?
We have a couple different disposal methods. One is percolation back into the basin. The other is we had a pretty flexible waste discharge permit with the regional board. We can use the secondary water for construction compaction, and we've been doing that for the last 5 or 6 years on some of the larger construction projects around, so we get some beneficial reuse. But the tertiary allows us to use it for landscape.
Okay. So the sewage from the development will go to your company through existing pipes. You'll treat it to secondary on that site. You'll send the secondary back to the project site where it will be treated for tertiary in a closed facility?
Yeah, it's basically a filtration system. They're pressure filters and then disinfection. After secondary, it's fairly clean and clear, but it doesn't quite meet the standard for tertiary. All the facilities, pipeline, filters, and everything are Fiera Lane Water Company facilities, so it'll be the one-stop shop for the regional board and compliance.
Tertiary is potable, correct?
Well, it meets a lot of the same potable standards. However, would probably not drink it in front of you today, but it meets bacterial standards that are very similar to potable.
Is that going to have a concrete structure sticking up, or is it just going to be shrubbery?
Actually, Chairman Malskow, that's an older graphic, but I wanted to at least show you conceptually what build-out was going to look like. Lot 10 on that graphic is absolutely accurate, but the roundabout does not exist.
Oh, it does.
As you can see in the aerial photo, exactly how the roadway distribution system is.
Okay.
Yet that would have been a little difficult, because I probably would have wanted to put a sculpture or a fountain, which flies in the face, if you will, of an emergency landing.
Right.
Put some ice plant there. Okay. Anyone else from your team?
No, sir.
Okay. I don't have any speaker slips. Anybody from the public wishes to address the commission on this matter? Seeing none, close the public hearing, bring it back to the board for further discussion and or actions.
There's no discussion. I would move adoption of the negative declaration in accordance with the applicable provisions of CEQA and approve conditional use permit DRC 2006-00214 and amend the conditional use permit S00007U based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the condition listed in Exhibit B.
Second.
I would just like to say I wish we had more master planned projects like this.
Wonderful. Right, and looks like there's several successful components here with the 227 task group, the water company expanding their service to do this tertiary treatment to use the water for landscaping. A lot of things make sense. This must be smart growth.
Yeah, anytime we can get away from septics and get into, you know, locally treated tertiary wastewater, I'm all for that.
Well, and secondly, and I guess it's because I still feel like I'm a San Luis Obispo citizen.
Well, used to be the mayor.
When you're talking about, you know, a gateway to the city and you have people that really take that into account, I think they should be commended.
Okay, enough of that platitudes.
You're
commended.
Let's have a roll call here.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Commissioner Malskow?
Yes.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. That concludes that item. We're moving on to the last hearing item of the day, hearing item number 4, which is...
What?
I think there's one more.
What happened to 5?
Oops, not the last item in here. I'm sorry. Nope. It's number 4. I'm sorry. Then we'll have 5.
Yep.
Hearing to consider a request by Anthony Randazzo for a variance coastal development permit. County file number DRC 2005-00247. Supervisorial District Number 2, Bill Robeson, Project Manager.
Good afternoon, Chairman Rose and Planning Commissioners Bill Robeson, County Planning. So this is a request for a variance and coastal development permit, and it is allowing grading on slopes in excess of 30%. The approximate slope is about 31.5%. So that is the trigger for a variance in our department. The variance also addresses construction requests for development. And what the applicant is requesting is an approximately 2,800 square foot two-story single family dwelling, including an approximately 492 square foot garage with storage and about 393 square feet of deck space. So let me point you to the aerial photo on the screen and give you some location information. The site's in Cayucas. It's outlined in blue. It is a downhill sloping lot from Richard Avenue. Santa Barbara Street is down at the bottom. There is a vacant lot to the west of this site. Oroville is down further west, and then Ocean Boulevard. And then Highway 1 is the next street over. From this view, you can also see surrounding development. There's construction taking place across the street, and many of the lots are built out. This is a little bit closer view. Richard, again, property lines laid out on the aerial photo. Santa Barbara Street is in this location. This is a site plan of the property. A rear elevation. There are some standards that require that that rear wall or that rear facing elevation be broken up and articulated architecturally. And I have some color renderings that I'll show you in just a moment. Yeah, also, I think I passed out a rendering of the kind of the streetscape elevation, and that takes me to this front elevation that we're looking at, where my pointer is, and it shows kind of a color rendering of how the house will look from the street. It's an 11 by 17, and the two neighboring homes on each side, which, again, are existing.
Wait a minute, don't leave. What I have looks different. That looks taller.
Yeah, this is a probably a rendering or a line drawing that shows the finished floor level of the home, and what you're looking at is kind of how it slopes down, and the street is kind of obscuring some of the front elevation in the color one that you have in front of you. So you okay. Kind of get a feel for the house kind of sits down lower than the crown of the road.
All right.
So there's several issues in this proposal, and let me just jump to one really quickly. There was a slight redesign, just for your information. The stairs were pushed back a little bit, not really much of a big change, and there was a redesign of these front entry columns. They were a little bit higher originally, and we had the applicant take those down to the required 3 feet. That's a close-up of those, although it's really not a large issue, and I'll move on to the large issues now. There's the rendering that I was speaking of just a moment ago. So one of the main issues is visual and scenic resources that we try to protect in the community of Cayucas. This demonstrates that the house is at a scale that meets the character of the neighborhood. The height of the house is at the required 28-foot height from average natural grade. And once again, you can see how it works in the midst of all the other homes. or a couple of the other homes. Going back to the elevations, this is a color rendering of how the house would fit in to the hillside. You can see the two homes next door. The articulation that I spoke of, you can see how the deck protrudes out or cantilevers out. We have some varying wall features so that we don't have just this massive-looking wall at the back. This photo gives you a feel for how the slope works. Once again, it is 30% plus. This is a view looking down towards Santa Barbara Street below. And this is the lot looking down from, I believe, Oroville. And these are some neighboring homes. This home is across the street on the uphill side of Richard. And this is a home not directly adjacent, but it's right down the street, which looks very similar in massing and in scale to the home that is proposed today. So I think I've touched on visual resources and protection of those. The second issue was geologic hazards and soil. There is a soils engineering and engineering geology report that has been prepared, and it was peer-reviewed by the county geologist. And the peer-review memo, if you would like to look at that briefly, it is on page 4-23 of your packet. And the project has been conditioned to include all the recommendations of the report. The other issues that we analyzed were concerns from the Cayucas Advisory Council. And most of those, if not all of those issues, were addressed in the conditions of approval. And they had to do with walls, retaining walls on each side, massing of the structure. And then as you can see on from that memo, it's on page 4-24 of your packet, there is a pretty lengthy discussion about how construction activity is to occur and how how these construction crews can be courteous to the neighbors during all this construction, because we do have a pretty narrow...
It's not here. Somebody's going to have to take their ball and run with it. Not seen anybody. Well, I guess I'll have to ask them then. One, and I think Ms. Carnegie, with her letter, kind of alluded to it. How do you build something like this in that steep lot when there's existing homes there? You got to dig something out before you put the footings and rebar and build your own things. How do you keep the neighboring lot from falling into your construction? How does that...
Well,
Mr. Marshall, he might say.
Okay.
Jump in if you'd like to, Bill. That's fine. I'll use the same terminology I used at the last meeting. It would be shoring what might be necessary. And typically you've got a 5-foot setback, I assume, on the property lines.
Correct.
And within that 5 foot, so at 3 feet, they might put down some shoring, then excavate behind the shoring, and then build their foundation for the building. Then they remove the shoring.
And that's all part of what the geological report required, knowing the soil types and so forth?
Well, I think they do require shoring if it's necessary, but a lot of times, from my experience, you can dig out that distance away from the other footing and it still can stand, the existing foundation can still stand on its own, but it's not recommended that be done for long periods of time or through the seasons throughout the year, but after that's dug out, you can quickly put those retaining walls in and pour in place foundation just to stabilize that once again.
All right. Next question is on page 4-8, condition 1B requires Richard Avenue to be improved during the project, extending to the county-maintained section of Richard Avenue. And it's going to be the standard A1 rural.
Hi, Glenn Marshall, County Public Works. So this is, I'm sorry, this is condition
1B.
1B. Approved for sending to Richard.
I would have expected Richard Avenue to already be to the county standards. I know there are some areas that people had gone through with because it didn't require variance, didn't have a conditional use permit, and therefore they skated free, and other people had to improve the road where it should have been more equitable. How much does this applicant have to do?
Well, the condition, a portion of Richard Road is not in the county maintained system. Are you familiar with this portion? Oh, maybe I'll defer to Tim Tomlinson.
I think he's volunteering. Let's go.
Yeah, let's let
Tim Tomlinson, Public Works. Per some recommendations and policy established by the Planning Commission many years ago, when Terry was doing this stuff, CSD asked that we try to get these roads that weren't county maintained up on the hillsides and parts of Cayugas improved to a standard that their garbage trucks and utility people could use better. So we settled on a standard 20-foot pavement width. In some places we get shoulder widths, in some places we can't get additional shoulder widths. Richards is one of the places where we can't really get an additional shoulder width because it just doesn't fit very well. So the standard here is for as you develop new discretionary properties, if there's a discretionary permit, we condition people to do road improvements to a standard that is the county standard we use here, which is kind of special, which is the 20-foot A1 section. Like I said, this is not the standard. This is a standard we use here because it needs to be specially tailored to the conditions on this hillside. If you don't have a minor use permit, you don't have a variance, we can't condition anybody to do these improvements. And a couple of the lots on Richard at the north end actually were purely ministerial permits, and those people were not required to do improvements. We request this condition on every project that's a discretionary permit.
Okay, and how far back is this guy going to have to go to meet it today?
Can you put a picture up there, Bill?
Oh, a little more detail on that.
Yeah.
That's better.
Okay, the large house that has two vacant lots on both sides of it right up the street, down. Right there. The county-maintained road is one lot south of that. A piece of road up to the house I just mentioned has been improved, but we haven't accepted it because it's only about 25, 50, or 50 feet long. I'm waiting for more road to get built before I accept that into the system. But so it's basically to the Fierro house, which is that isolated house right there with all the green stuff around it. It isn't that far. There are other projects beyond this that are also conditioned to build that piece of road. And whoever wants to get their final first gets to actually get the road built.
And is there some means that you guys have of, you know, so they can share on that?
We can't make anyone do that. There are properties that are trying to work together to do that individually.
The street plan and profile is about the only one Public Works has any. The drainage ditches, well, A and B, and we would leave the drainage ditches culverts because those might apply to the road improvements. So I would recommend we scratch 8C, D, E, and F.
Charlie Delco, Delta Echo and Foxtrot.
Thank you.
We rarely remove parts of things. This is amazing.
First, first time. Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, open up to the applicant and the applicant's agent.
Good afternoon. I'm Alex De Leon with Costa De Leon Properties. We're the designers of the project. Don't have a lot to add. His presentation was pretty thorough. When we started this project a year ago with the Randazzos, as one of our goals was to get them the home that they wanted that fit within the parameters of both the development standards and what the community, the neighbors would expect to see there. So I think that we achieved that goal. As you can see from the drawings that have been submitted, both the construction drawings and the color renderings, we've fit in with the character and the scale and massing of the adjacent buildings. And the photograph that he had up earlier shows there's other homes of similar architectural style in the neighborhood. So I'm really just here to answer any questions that you might have, because I think that everything that was in the staff report and his oral presentation presented the project fairly well. I do want to mention there was a question about the construction parking. I worked on a couple projects in the Heights in Pismo, and I noticed that the contractors created a level area early on in the project where their construction trucks could park. In this particular case, the sort of guest parking pad that's to the side of the driveway is probably something the contractor would build fairly early on. That gives them a place where cars can, where trucks can pull off of the road and park during construction phase, which on this house, you know, could be kind of lengthy because of the terrain. There was also a question about during construction, how do you keep the adjacent property or walls from falling in? There's actually more fill on this project than there is cut. So usually it's a concern if you're doing a lot of cutting next to your neighbor's walls. In this case, the actual cutting into the hill is not that much. It's maybe, I think it's about 4 feet at the most when you're getting near the neighbors, because that front stretch of the site between the front of the house and the street is mostly fill. So the walls that are getting built are out of the ground. They're in the air, and then they come in with fill. And then I had a question about the condition that was just being talked about. The one that was 1B. I guess when I first read this, I thought they were talking about just the improvement on this strip of street directly in front of the property.
Oh, no.
But my question is, he mentioned the house that's under construction across the street. Did that one have the same condition to do the improvement all the way down to the end of the county maintained road? And if so, does that mean if they get to their final first, they've already done it so we don't have to?
Yep.
Does my question make sense?
Go ahead and answer it now.
The problem with the public works, yes, except I believe they're in foreclosure, so they're probably not going to. There are still three projects further north than you that I think are possibly still active. They haven't started doing anything yet. We're also conditioned. But yeah, everything between you and the current county maintained road that is has a project currently has been conditioned to do this. And if you want to come talk to me, at some time I can point to some of those folks.
Okay.
Seems like you guys ought to share phone numbers and work that out.
Yeah.
And he'll give you his card and you can make that happen.
Then I'm just here to, besides that, I'm just here to answer any questions that you might have.
I had one. I didn't drive to the site because I've been on Richard Avenue I don't know how many times, but I was looking at staff's pictures and much of the surrounding houses look sort of light white colors, and your home looks a little darker. Is that just because the way the photographs were taken? Or
it's the disadvantage
my
of
concern is
working with photographs for the neighbor's house,
right,
but trying to do it a color rendering for yours, it tends to be bolder just because it's hard to do things very lightly. But the actual colors that got turned in are Alhambra standard stucco colors. They're not any custom mixed deep rich tones. And so in the course of the computer...
Well, for the public, seeing none, no one's coming for us, so I'll close the public hearing and bring it back to the commission for further discussion and or motions.
Well, since the planning commissioner for the district isn't here today, and I'll make the motion in her stead. And I move that we adopt negative declaration ED07051 in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code Section 2100 et sec, and that we approve variance DRC 2005-00247 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B.
As amended.
Which were just removing those Charlie Delta Echo Foxtrots.
I'll second the motion.
All right. Further discussion? Seeing none. Roll call vote.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Mascow?
Yes.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. And with that, now we can move into hearing item number 5, which I believe is the last hearing item of the day. Could you introduce that? She's scrambling for more papers.
Hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend the land use element, land use categories from rural lands and open space ag. Amendments to the Adelaida Area Plan, amendments to the Las Palitas Area Plan, and amendments to the Shannon Carrizo Area Plan. County file number LRP 2007-00017, Supervisorial Districts 1, 2, and 5, Terry Waller, Project Manager.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. Terry Waller, Planning Staff. This item before you today is really just a follow-up as well as a requirement of the Agricultural Preserve Program. These properties require amendments because they do not currently have agricultural land use categories and they are in agricultural preserves and under contract. The Williamson Act requires restrictive zoning such as agriculture for properties that are under contract. The rules of procedure, the county's implementing document for the program also require it. And framework for planning also specifies that agricultural preserve properties should have agriculture as a land use category. And with that, I'd like to just go ahead and show you the slides of the actual changes very quickly. There are 7 properties, and they do have 2 slides each because we're changing the land use category, in most cases from rural lands to agriculture, as well as changing the designation in the ag and open space element map from large lot rural in most instances to agriculture land under contract. So with that, I'll just go ahead and proceed through this. The first item is a property, I should say, is the Baldwick property, and it consists of 200 acres. The request is to amend the land use element from rural lands to agriculture and to also amend the ag and open space designation map from large lot rural to agriculture land under conservation contract. This is the land use category map. And this is the ag and open space element designation change.
Before we introduce the next one, I was advised that we had to have seven separate hearings on this. We couldn't accomplish them all at once.
I did discuss that with council, and it is my understanding. We have 2 councils here, so that would be nice to have that benefit. But I do understand that since these are listed as a single item with a group of different changes, that it's okay to do it as a single item.
Okay.
Correct?
All right.
Okay. That shall simplify everything for us.
All right, great.
So again, this is the Ag and Open Space map for the Baldwin property. The next one is the Morrison property. It's east of Cambria. It's a 360-acre site. It is, again, an amendment from rural lands to agriculture and large lot rural to agriculture land under conservation contract. Here is the land use category map change and the ag and open space map change for this property. If there's any questions, seeing none. The third property is the Pendleton property. It's a 573-acre site. It is a similar request, rural lands to agriculture for the land use category map and large lot rural to land under conservation contract for the ag and open space. This one is a little unusual in that there's 2 sites, but the Williamson Act and our local rules allow property owners with 2 contiguous sites to put 2 properties under the same. So the land use category map, this is zoning. This is rural land zoning, and it would go to agriculture. And here we are on the ag and open space element map that I was speaking of. And the current designation is a large lot rural under, again, the ag and open space map, and that would go to agriculture land under conservation contract. We actually have, I might point out, 2 designations under the ag and open space map for agriculture. We have regular agriculture, and then we have agriculture with a parenthetical statement that represents land under conservation contract. On to item 5. Oops. Back here. Is the Parsons property. It's an 85-acre property. Again, it's a this property is from open space to agriculture. There's actually a typo on my slide here. So it's actually open space, and it's open space because it was in public ownership. And he had a cattle lease on it. It's adjacent to an existing agricultural preserve. He wanted to add this 85-acre property that he had been leasing, and so he purchased it from the government. So the change is from open space to agriculture in this instance, the only one, and it is an amendment on the ag and open space map from multi-use public land to agriculture land under conservation contract.
Was that BLM or National Forest, or was it
I
state?
Think it, as I recall, it's Padre National Forest.
Los Padres National Forest?
Los Palitos. So I guess that's where it would be. I could check the file if you'd like. Anyway, technical difficulty. There we go. This is the change to the land use category map, and you can see the open space designation on that. And the property right below it, it's actually part of that larger property that shows as surrounding public lands on the darker screen in the lower part of the slide. And this shows the change on the ag and open space map from to land under agriculture land under conservation contract from the multi-use designation that it was in previously. And the next property, the sixth property, is the Friend property. This is out in the California Valley. It's a 120-acre site. The property owner actually owns a bunch of land next to this, adjacent to this property, but it qualified individually, and she put it in as an individual property rather than adding it to the existing contract. And the amendment is from rural lands to agriculture once again. And from large lot rural to agriculture in the ag and open space map. There is the land use category change. And the second slide is the ag and open space designation change. The seventh and final property is a 160-acre property under the Wilson ownership. And again, it's an amendment from rural lands to agriculture and the ag and open space map, farm large lot rural to agriculture land under conservation contract. And here's the land use category map change. And here is the change to the ag and open space element map. And that would, one more slide. Staff recommends that the Planning Commission recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of the general plan amendment, as shown in the exhibits LRP 2007-00018-1A and B, since there's two each, all the way through LRP 2007-00018-7A and B, and that's based on the findings in the staff report. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
The only question I have, the staff report indicates that actually some of these started a long time ago, in 2002, and that you decided to batch them?
That's correct.
Do we do this often? I mean, it just seems to me like...
Not real often, it looks like.
Obviously not.
Well, actually, I'll give you a little bit of background on that. As you know, about in 2002, Frank Heinzen left, who administered the program for many years, and I took over the program, and I had a bit of catching up to do on lots of stuff. And he left me a pretty big tub of work also. And so what we decided to do was to try to do these in batches when we had a collection of them. He actually had some general plan amendments that also needed to be done, and I finished those up for him in 2003 or 4, I believe it was. And then these have sort of been accumulating for the last couple of years. It is our intention to do these more regularly. We'll probably be doing them in fewer numbers because we only get about... Oh, I don't know, maybe one every other year, possibly two every other year, something like that. So it averages out to about one a year, I guess. So we'll probably be taking these back to you on a more regular basis.
Based on the findings set forth in this report.
I'll second that, except I notice what you put up in front of you had A and B. Do you want A and B in the motion?
I don't think that's necessary because whatever council would like.
Okay, I'll second it.
It's a little clear.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, I'll have a roll call vote then.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Milskoff?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. How about all the stuff we received today? What should we do with it?
I would move we enter into the record all the communications we received today.
Second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. It's unanimous. Okay, we're adjourned until our next meeting, which is
May the 8th,
regular time, 08:45 in these chambers. Thank you very much.